Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 6th, 2021, and welcome to episode 236 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever find my way back to
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and trying to get our various recording equipment running. I think we have succeeded in doing that. Time will tell. I'm Paul Hextrom in Boston. I am joined by four retro computing enthusiasts today, the first of whom on my screen is Carrington Vanson in Toronto. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing excellent. Bingo card check.
Excellent. Fantastic, I think is how that goes.
Fantastic. Where's my mug?
And also joining us today is Blake Patterson in Northern Virginia. How are you?
I'm fine. It's nice and hot, and it's all cicadas all the time everywhere around here. So,
yes. Yes, we're just going to ask about that.
We're at the fever pitch, I think, right
no
now.
Thank you, no, thank you.
I think yesterday I had the most that I've had land on me in one day yesterday was, I believe, 14 when we were out on our walk. And they're quite the swarming thing. You know, I can almost hear the drone through two panes of glass in this room. So, yes, I think we're at the peak. We've got a few more weeks, and then they go away. They're periodic in some places. They're constant in small numbers and others, and many places don't have them at all. So kind of a strange thing. Everyone's like, that's not how I remember cicadas, but it's, yeah, I'll be glad when it's over. But otherwise, doing well.
Excellent. And joining us again today is Michael Mulhern in Sydney. How are you?
Frightfully cold here. It's down into single digits, so my brain's not working.
Yeah, that is a interesting contrast. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, how you guys have got the seasons all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's right, yeah.
That's right. We're almost in triple digits here on a different scale.
Right.
Yep. That's right, mm-hmm. Fahrenheit, yeah. Glad to be back. Hopefully I can make the entire episode without any more technical issues.
Time will tell. Lastly, joining us from Stockholm is Jack Nutting. How are you?
Hello, I'm doing good. Enjoying some warm weather here in Stockholm. Not hot like Atlanta, but medium warm like Stockholm in the summer.
Like Stockholm in the summer, yeah. That's nice.
Oh, that old phrase.
That'd be a nice folk song. Stockholm in the summer. Yeah, get a few strumming guitars there. I think we could do it.
So we decided last time that our topic this time was going to be, I think we basically just said computers in school, and everybody said, oh, that's great. I have 4 hours of worth of stuff to say. Yeah. It's possible that has something to do with why we have so many people here, and even we would have had more. So I think my guess is that this topic is going to go on for a couple of episodes. So I think we'll see how it goes, but... anyway, there's not much in by way of parameters. I guess we all had our own idea of what that was going to mean. I have my idea, but it may not match everybody else's. So I think how should we do this? I guess maybe we can start with Blake, since we've already heard that there was stuff to be said. So what about computers and schools and all that do you have for us?
Sure. Well, I guess what I interpreted the topic to mean, I was just going to talk a bit about, I was in school During a period where it was sort of novel, not as novel as paper tape and punch cards, but sort of novel to see, you know, what we'd call the home computer in the schools. I recall when they appeared in my surroundings, and I thought I'd just talk about that a little bit, just walk back through. I guess if that sounds good to everyone, I'll proceed. And the first, I guess, encounter I remember, I guess it was would have been 1983 or so, 82, 83. There was the school, I went to a public high school in Southern Virginia where the one classroom had two Apple IIe, or actually there were Apple II pluses brought in, and that was the first I'd ever seen of computers in school. During this time, I took a summer computer course at a neighboring school, and you know they had set up a lab for this, but it wasn't regular use. And then I went at this point I switched schools and went, I guess, about the sixth grade level. I was in a school that had a small room full of Commodore PETs with the tape drives. It was probably three or four of them I think it was basically a closet, and it was only offered, there were classes offered for seniors to take courses, programming courses, I guess it was basic on these. Later, I remember those were taken out of the school, and that computer room was turned into a teacher's smoking lounge. Interestingly, the room was, and so but following that, apparently it was removed because they had purchased Apple IIe's and set up an Apple II lab.
Meanwhile, Jeremy has put in a nice comment in the chat, smoking in the pet room.
Yep.
Indeed. So a new lab was set up with Apple IIe's, and they probably had, I think there were probably 20, and there was typing classes at this point. There were basic classes. I guess this was, you know, 87 or something like that. But interestingly, an extension of this took place, which was a writing lab. And it was basically for, if you didn't have a word processor at home, you know, all papers at this point, because of the computer lab, had to be typed, and the lab was entirely filled with Laser 128 Apple II clones, which was interesting. And I think I know that there was a local individual who worked for, you know, VTech, or that's the company behind the Laser, right? VTech?
I think that's correct.
Yeah. And he was like a regional salesperson that worked out of his house. And I think they actually went through this guy. That's where I got my Laser 128 a few years earlier. Interestingly, the lasers would give up the gray smoke with some frequency. I think it was about once a week. There would literally be a smoking laser, and then that would be carted off. These were the second models, which were a little more stylish in their design, but apparently, and from what I've heard, maybe a little bit less robust than the clankier looking original model.
Perfect for the smoking pet room.
That's right. Well, at this point, we'd moved out of this was beyond the smoking room. But yes, they were still smoking in the pet room. And actually, I think at that point, that was gone. the teachers did not always have the smoking lounge. They decided that maybe that was a strange thing, I guess, to have in the middle of a school. Finally, rounding out of that school, some PC clones were brought in for AP Computer Science. I took, you know, Pascal programming in that class, I think, 11th grade or something like that. And, you know, that's what I remember from, you know, the high school years. Interestingly, going into this, it was still, at least from what I remember, around the time, like 82, 83, it was still a novel thing to walk into an office or an establishment and see, like, a PC where someone was doing bookkeeping on it. You just didn't see those things. I remember being interested in it. I would take particular note and go annoy the person that was, you know, as a kid that was working on it, asking questions and looking at what cables were plugged into the back. It was still such a novel thing. We all were a little bit ahead of the curve, I think, at this time. I'm sure we all had, you know, this or that machine, you know, computer at home, but certainly that was not typical. But I mean, that's the core, I guess, of the early days. You know, I could, there's nothing particularly stand out about, you know, college that followed. Things were, you know, the web was about to arrive and things happened. I guess an interesting little tidbit of, you know, early college is simply the first machine we worked on before a major upgrade with Sun workstations and a lot more HP UX systems were set up. People were using, doing a lot of remote access on a Prime mini computer. Does anyone remember the yeah. Prime? PR numeral 1ME was the name, Prime.
If I'm not mistaken, the main experience that I have had with Prime is looking for ads, you know, for the middle of the podcast and finding Tom Baker, you know, doing ads for the Prime computer.
Okay. I don't remember. I know that from this context. I don't remember that from back in the day. And I actually don't remember ever encountering any mention of, I had never heard of the Prime before in any capacity.
I'm a non-Prime user.
Well, I was certainly a non-Prime user. I think it would actually handle if you upgraded non-Prime numbers. But yes, the original could only compute Prime numbers. That was a limitation. But it did have an odd limitation, the biggest thing, and this will close me out. I think I've, you know, said my piece there, is that it took a lot of doing for me to figure out why I couldn't communicate with it. And the Prime little nuance, it was 7-bit ASCII. Like it needed to have a terminal program set to, you know, 7 bits. That wasn't immediately obvious. And I remember it was days trying to figure out why. And yeah, that was someone, I think I found out on the Usenet that, yeah, the Prime is kind of funky and that it won't, you know, it doesn't take the standard 8-in-1 on its terminal connection. But that was only there for a few months. And then that was gone. I think it had been there for quite some time. But I saw it physically, kind of a little box that the size of a little refrigerator, I think, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. But and I've written a couple of things, a couple of blog posts that I will we can link. I know our user, we had a user group. I've been in a number of user groups, and one of them happened to be this Atari group when I had the ST, and there was a private school that was local, and they had a big their lab was they were all 8-bit Atari, like Atari 800, actually 800 XL era machines. And so that was interesting. That school was entirely Atari. And another little memory that wasn't, you know, core to my own educational pathway. But so those just, you know, some memories I have. And, you know, it was certainly a different situation than now, where, you know, my daughter, since she was in the fourth grade, has been loaned a Chromebook from the school. All work mm-hmm. is done on the Chromebook, basically. And that's been the way she's in high school now. And it's, that's how you do it. She's taking SOLs this week, standard of learning tests. You got to do well on those or you're SOL.
I always had similar thoughts about point of sale systems.
Yes.
When I see those abbreviated.
I have a friend that would repair faulty POS machines at Busch Gardens. And every time a lightning strike would happen, they would call out get on the CB and get all the techs out there. And they didn't refer to them as point of sale, but the abbreviation did hold fast. Yeah. The exams are all on the computer, you know, and instantly graded, and it's quite a different time now.
So you mentioned that you started out in a place that where there was something like a room of pets, right?
So it sounds like a room of pets.
Yeah, but so the it does sound like there was some push by the school to get this in front of kids. I mean, the Atari thing actually that you mentioned is similar to that. That might be a company push, but, you know, the mm-hmm. company tells, you know, donates a bunch of computers to try to hook the kids. But yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I was thinking about just out of curiosity, like what, you know, to what extent in those early times where we encountered computers, that was because we had to, mm-hmm. or because, you know, we were the lone ones on the computer while everybody else was at recess.
Right, you know? Right. And, you know, and yes, speaking of out at recess, you remind me that, yeah, somewhere in between, you know, before that Apple II lab, there was a periodical room that got a 2E, and at lunchtime or during recess, I would go to the periodical room, you know, being the geek that I was, and spent all this time in there playing with the 2E. So clearly there wasn't some corporate push in my school. This was a private school I happened to go to. And the Atari school was a private school as well. There was a desire. It's hard to say how it was structured because there were so few. I mean, there were 3 or 4 pets. You could only access it if you were a senior. There wasn't a lot of talk about it. I mean, it didn't seem like a high profile thing. And then it went away. I'm sure someone gave, you know, maybe a benefactor gave the pets, and the whole thing was put on hold for a bit, but clearly they, you know, they regrouped, and maybe, I don't know if Apple had a hand in, you know, setting up a room of 20 or so 2Es, but at that point it became a big priority. But even in the sixth grade, like in 83 or so, it in some regard, yes, there was a drive to, you know, offer that and get that in front of people. But they didn't get it in front of many. You know, it wasn't until years later that anybody but just a handful of interested seniors were able to do that.
So it was sort of self-selected. People who wanted to found it, but people who didn't care didn't.
Yeah, I mean, and I think it was a class, like an elective, and I think because it was so few, I imagine if there were more than, you know, 10 people that wanted to, it would be difficult. It was a small school. I think we had like 60 people per grade for these years of my life in this little private school that I was sent to. And I don't know. It always seemed odd to me that the small number of machines, and it also was a class. So was, you know, did people maybe come in at lunch? I didn't, you know, I don't know what was going on. I was way down in the sixth grade. This is a 6th through 12th school. But yes, at the time, you know, like I had my, you know, TI going into the school. I was the first person that the teacher had ever seen hand in a word processed in the sixth grade. She'd never had a student hand in a word processed printed report before. She was fascinated when I, you know, she said, "Oh, typing." I said, "Well, it's a word processor, Daisy Wheel, you know, Smith Corona printer."
So it looked typed. It was Daisy Wheel.
Yeah, it looked typed, and she said, "Oh, typed." You know, the teacher commented, you know, gave a nod, and I said, "Well, I have a word processor, and I just got a printer." And, you know, of course, I talk on and on. I probably told her all how it's a parallel printer and hooks into the first port, but there's also a serial port on that, on this, an RS-232 parallel card, but I'm only using the parallel, you know, and she, I'm sure she's like, okay. But, but she said, and that's maybe that's the most interesting nugget here is that in 1984. She said, no one's handed in a word processed paper before. And, you know, and I said, well, if they do, you can tell them it doesn't get any more advanced than TI Writer with its 30 column, with its 3 panes of 30 column text. You know, I said,
you're like a little salesperson.
You're living in the high country when you're, you know, when you're laying down documents with TI Writer, you know. In fact, you know, I still use it today for all my professional.
That is so funny because I had kind of the opposite experience. I had the first time, or one of the first times I handed homework in that I had done on a computer and printed out, not on a fancy TI Writer impact printer, or rather I used a some sort of dot matrix thing. And the teacher wouldn't accept it. It said, no, you have to be typewritten or handwritten. None of this whole hard to read bunch of dots. Huh. So I got my homework rejected because I was too far into the future.
Well, it's funny because it's one of the first things that, like, I would kind of guide my parents, you know, I'd say, you know, mom, dad, can we get this computer or whatever? But the only thing that I ever was surprised with that my, you know, parents went out and did was my dad. I guess he became aware, like, he worked at NASA, so he'd have these, you know, geeky guys that, I mean, these guys had computers too. Like, I remember going over to dinner and a guy had an Apple II Plus with Flight Simulator 2. He'd put his joystick on the floor and had a balsa wood stick you know, and he'd fly the thing, you know, like, while they were eating dinner, they set me in front of that thing, and I was there for, like, you know, an hour and a half flying Flight Simulator 1 or 2. But he became aware that there was a mom-and-pop computer store, near NASA, that had a sale on an old model of this Smith Corona. It was, you know, I came to realize that daisy wheel printers are rather expensive because they look so nice and whatever. This was just cheap, and I didn't like it because it wouldn't do graphics. So I was glad to have a printer, but, like, I remember, you know, is there some program where I can just use the period in a lot of places? Just I want to draw a picture. So I was not happy about it. But I wonder, it's interesting, maybe at that point, you make a good point, Carrington, maybe all the points on your dot matrix document, maybe that looked crappy to teachers, you know, and maybe I would have gotten pushback.
Yeah, compared to a typewreter or a daisy wheel, like early dot matrix with a 9x9 grid or whatever, it looked
terrible.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
But I could do graphics, know, the ribbons so would suck
be, it. The ribbons would often be, they wouldn't be dark, you know, like you'd get in, you know, varying levels, especially because, you know, it reused itself. And
honestly, yeah. I probably was dumb enough. I probably handed it in still fan folded together with all the stuff on the side, the tractor. So probably, what is this? So there could be more to the story that I'm remembering. I'm often my own worst enemy.
Well, we've talked before about the narrow little plotter that both Carrington and I each had one of our respective platforms.
I didn't
and
use that one.
I used that to make – we had a project that every student would do in 10th or 11th grade. It was called the Leaf Project. Everybody in my high school had to do this, where we had a big list of types of trees, and you had to wander around the town looking for these trees to gather leaves, and then you'd press them in like a photo album with like the sticky paper or the sticky plastic in front of it. And I used my little plotter to make little labels for each leaf and like a table of contents to put in the front inside of like one sticky page. And that blew people away. And actually, I still have it. I have it today. It's like one of the only things I did in like in school ever that I kept, and I still have it. That was fun.
And it wasn't on thermal paper, right? So
no.
It was plotted with pens.
Yeah, it's a plotter thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
tiny little pens. I'll go grab it so we can see how it looks. I'll be back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just wish I had school memories.
Well, yeah. So, Michael, yeah. What was your experience in school?
Well, that's exactly what I meant. We didn't have computers at school, so next host to comment, please. Computers. When I was I finished high school when I was 16. This was back in 1980, and computers were something that you saw at the movies, the archetypal Hollywood spinning tapes going back and forth, not actually doing the seek, flashing lights and things like that. No computers at the school. So my first introduction to computers was in a lecture theater with the computer guy basically teaching us Fortran using an overhead projector in the lecture theater, and then introducing us to punch cards and mark sense cards. And basically that first or second lecture, we basically handed in our first program on mark sense cards without actually having ever touched a computer. Mm-hmm. And then they basically ran it, and it was literally just a Fortran Hello World program.
And to this day, Michael has never touched a computer.
No. But back to sort of like off that, how Blake was saying that he was using word processors and TI Write and things along those lines. Even though I was at uni and then later on found the computer lab up in the School of Science, word processor programs weren't exactly common, having to spend money and all that sort of thing. And I had at this stage taught myself how to do programming in BASIC, a bit of an introduction to assembler in 6502. And I got sick and tired of handwriting my assignments for assessment, and couldn't get my hands on a word processor. So I wrote myself a very simple, I was going to say BASIC, but it was like a combination of BASIC and assembler.
Did you write TI Writer? Are you the author?
Okay. No.
I think that's
no,
you just described
I wrote
it.
A very basic script
sure?
editor. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm positive. I'm not. So I wrote my own word processor so I could hand in my assignments typed up on an Apple II Euro Plus.
Hilariously, that describes most software development. You probably typed 30,000 lines of code so you can write a 500-word assignment.
No, actually.
Yeah.
I was the guy who, well, not the only one, but I was one of the ones that, if an assessment item was due to be pigeonholed at 10 a.m., I was the one that was rushing in with but seconds to spare to lodge it into the pigeonhole. And I'd only actually started writing it when the library opened at 8 a.m. that morning. Amazingly, they were the assignments that normally got me the higher marks rather than the ones where I actually had time to spend on them. So, I think that's my whole sort of education type thing. Leave it to the last moment, get the best marks. But, it's my high school didn't have computers until the year after I left, and they'd only put in one computer, so one Apple IIe, I think it was. We'd heard that other schools had had computers, but maybe it was something about being a Christian Brothers school that the brothers had other things on their mind.
The Apple II Euro Plus in Australia, was the Euro Plus the one that was used everywhere?
Euro Plus was the most common. To start with, it used full strength electricity, not that half strength stuff that you guys use. Yeah, we teach our children to be very careful not to stick knives and things into PowerPoint, so we don't have to cut back the electricity.
It's only because when the electricity pours around the earth and it gets to the bottom, it pools up. That's why you have so much of it. That's science.
Ah, we're stealing your electricity. Yeah, you go Oz. Yes. Yes, we'll put it in batteries and send it back to you. I would have loved to have had computers at school. I think I would have been the guy in there. I just sort of took to computers. Once I found them at university, I just fell in love with computers with punch cards and mark sense cards putting assignments in on the PDP. The first non-assessment item that I wrote in Fortran was basically a dungeon crawler in Fortran, cool. With it being done on a punch card.
Nice. So you punch in, move north, and then submit it.
yeah. No, it was to create the dungeon in a dungeon crawl style, which I then would run as a DM.
Nice.
Which, of course, I then found out that the machine didn't have a true random function. So when I ran it the second time, it started out, it basically did exactly the same thing. So I had to simulate a random function in that so that I could do that. So basically, early computers, I love them. You would encounter a problem, and not having this internet thing, you couldn't go and find a solution. You had to create your own solutions. And so I suppose it was the era of so many people all around the world, so like reinventing the same wheel, but for each of them it was a new experience every single time. Even a group of us, we wrote a when the mouse was first available for the Apple II Euro Pluses, we wrote a tabbed interface for a suite of stuff that we were doing. So we had mouse control, tabbed interfaces, drop-down menus. Well, actually, they were pop-out menus because you had to be sparing with what you could do. So there was pop-out, pop-in menus and things like that. So,
very nice.
And then so years later, you go, hey, we might have actually done that before somebody else. Oh, well, fine. We'll go do something else. But, really, me... I did not find computers till university. I was a brash young 17-year-old at university, and suddenly I was in love with computers.
Yeah, it's sort of a different way in a sense. I mean, like certainly the threshold is much higher if you're trying to get people to fall in love with punching cards and sending them off and waiting for results.
Yep. Yeah, well, that was the thing. Students did mark sense, and the lecturers and the tutors were doing punch cards. And I found early on that the punch cards went into a different input queue, And I taught myself to use the punch card machine downstairs outside the computer room. And without even asking the person at the behind the glass wall, it was almost like a teller type arrangement, I would just put a rubber band around my pile of cards and just pass it in. And I would say, oh, when do you think I'd be able to pick this up? It had my name, student number there. It wasn't my student number, it was my computer user number, which was exactly the same sort of number sequence that the faculty would use. So they would just pick up my pile of cards and they would put it onto the faculty queue. And I was actually getting my stuff run two or three times a day, as opposed to if you're lucky, you'll get it back during the day and you can put it in again. Most of the time, the students would run overnight. So
hacking the system.
Yes, I was basically hacking the system with punch cards.
Very cool.
Nice.
So maybe we got someone else there who actually did use computers at school. Mind you, I'm now on a tangent there. I'm actually scanning a lot of stuff and putting up on the Internet Archive Eduware titles and discs and things that I'm finding here, predominantly for Australian educational stuff. So I've found a Computer Education Centre resource set of discs, 18 discs with mostly commercial or freeware, shareware type of titles, but all repackaged and done that way. So I've just finished loading those disc images up to the Internet Archive and making them bootable using all the whiz-bangery that Jason has provided that we see for 4am and all the others. I've done a few Sunburst educational titles, all the scanning and whatnot, and getting those up there. So, you know, to me, I suppose I'm making up for my lack of using computers at school by rescuing titles that I don't see scanned or available anywhere, or particular Australian flavour or bent on bits and pieces that are there, and getting those up into the Internet Archive. You know, even to the extent of, you know, if I see an item on eBay that I'm now sort of bidding on those things, not for my own personal interest, but for historical and preservation reasons. So it's just a different way of spending the pocket money. So as I said, I'm making up for lost time by saving what little bits and pieces that I can find.
It seems like it's pretty, you know, it's pretty entertaining to look at what the you know, child targeted stuff was at the time.
Yeah,
because you sure didn't want to look at it back then, as far as the education.
Yeah, all right.
At least me.
Well, Jack, what was your school experience like? You're sort of probably more in the same ballpark as me.
Yeah, probably so. So I remember that in fifth grade, when I just moved to Minnesota. We had there was one Apple II Plus that the school district had for all the fifth grade classes in the town to share, and so it kind of went from one school to the next. And I remember it came to our school last in the year, which for scheduling reasons turned out to be good because we got extra time, whereas the others got like 4 weeks, we got 5 or 6 weeks or something. And they had they took all of us students who they reasoned were good at math. And said, let's let them try this thing. And they had a teacher who came from somewhere who taught us a little bit of basic programming. We had a book. I remember that, just like the weird things you remember. I remember the book talked about that you could press break to break out a running program. And that you could type C-O-N-T to continue. And it said in there, press C-O-N-T to continue. And the C-O-N-T was like in computer font. And one of the other kids in my class was reading this out loud in our little class. And took great joy in not saying C-O-N-T, but saying the fraction of the word continue that matches those letters in an attempt to embarrass the teacher, who acted completely cool and just did not react. It was we all thought this was hilarious, and he was being very subversive, and the teacher just didn't even address it, which was perfect.
Yeah.
But so that was my first use of a computer where I actually got to sit down and do something and try programming. Like, that's where my first basic program was on that Apple II Plus. And, you know, I didn't do much. I remember being able to enable the low-res graphics mode and draw some boxes and, you know, use print and input. And they probably had us do a little bit of for loops and a bit of go-to and that kind of thing. And I remember that at some point I was doing stuff and I was using just like the direct mode, the immediate mode, where you could type You could go into graphics mode and then start drawing boxes. You know, if you didn't type a line number, it was an immediate mode command, and it would just happen. And I remember at some point, like, I had done all this stuff and tried to save it, and it didn't save. And, like, I just remember, like, that light bulb moment of, oh, wait, it's the line numbers that make it into a thing that is remembered instead of just something that happened right now. And it's like, it was just like a, and then I remember trying to explain this to someone else who's having the same problem, and I remember that I failed to explain it, but I understood it. And then I remember through middle school, this Apple II Plus experience was 1982, end of fifth grade. In the middle school for 3 years, we didn't have a lot of computers that I had access to at all. I remember there was some kind of remote access, like, terminal thing in the library through which the librarian and people who knew what they were doing could connect to something else, you know, somewhere elsewhere in Minnesota to connect to some index of library stuff. And I remember occasionally there would be an Apple II of some kind that would get wheeled into a classroom somewhere, like, to do something like print shop. So you could, like, have the class make a little newsletter or something, that kind of thing. And it would be kind of on a cart, the way they'd have, like, a TV and a VCR on a cart. There'd be, like, an Apple IIe or an Apple II Plus on a cart, you know, strapped to the top of the cart so they could wheel it around. And I remember there was one teacher, a math teacher, who he had an Apple IIe in the classroom on his desk. And what he would do is he would give us an assignment to do something, so we'd be busy for our 45 minutes, and then he would sit at his Apple IIe and type very fast and very loud for the remaining 40 minutes. Like, I don't know if he was working on a novel or what. Like, whatever he was doing, it was not math. It was like if you hear someone who was just typing words, just loud, loud, fast typing on the loud, loud Apple IIe keyboard, as loud as he could go, as fast as he could go.
Yeah, he was probably doing some program contracting on the side.
Playing Zork.
Playing Zork. I don't know. Right. But he was typing a lot, and he was typing fast.
Go north, go north, go north.
Did he stop occasionally and go,
No, no, he would stop occasionally and go out and go to the smoking lounge.
Oh, okay.
Which was right next door.
No, he smoked a pet as well.
Yeah, smoked a pet. And then in high school, we had a bit more. There was an Apple II lab that had a bunch of, it must have been Apple IIe's. And, like, if you took a programming course, like a basic programming course, in fact, I think there was two. I think there was, like, programming one and programming two. You could take one and then the other. And I'm sure I took both, but I may be misremembering. Maybe there's only one. But anyway, if you were taking a programming course, then you got access to be able to go in the lab and do stuff. And I remember doing things like there, you know, by that time I had figured out how to do the high-res graphics on the Apple II and, like, drawing lines moving around and stuff. And it was pretty fun, but it was not really, again, not very widespread. You know, most people did not have any access to that computer room and didn't know anything about what to do in there. And then, you know, a couple years later, by the time we went to college, suddenly computers were kind of everywhere. And, you know, in college we had a number of labs of terminals, but also labs of Macs and PCs and a variety of things. So I kind of went from being, you know, in middle school and high school, I had a computer at home, and some of my friends did too. And occasionally you saw a computer in school used for something, but pretty unusual. And then by college, it's just, boom, it was just everywhere. Not in the sense of today, it wasn't like not every student had a computer in their room, but everyone had access to them somewhere. Mm-hmm. So
yeah. Somebody thought it was important.
Yes. I was going to show you guys one thing, and since this podcast is essentially an audio medium, you can edit this out if you want later, Paul. But this is, I found my Leaf project we were talking about. So,
oh, excellent.
Classic beige photo album. And if I open it up here, the inside front page, this is the table of contents I printed. It shows all the leaves I gathered and what page number they're on. And then I have all the leaves pressed in between pages like this. And I made a little label for each leaf indicating where I got it and that sort of thing. And this is all done with the plotter, and it kind of blew people away. And I think what blew people away most, actually, was this title that was larger than the other text. Because people at this time were kind of used to seeing maybe a dot matrix printer output or maybe, you know, a daisy wheel output, but not really seeing something that you could actually make larger. Like, that was pretty wild. People were like, did you find a laser printer to print that on? Right. And I was like, nope, that's my little
plotter. Blake thought he was in the high country, but oh no.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And I do have to say, like, looking back at this, I'm reminded that on each one of these little things, I made a note of, like, where I found this and the date that I found this and that sort of thing. And I want to say, for the sake of honesty and posterity, that this is actually complete fiction, because most of these leaves I did not gather myself. I got the excess leaves from my friend Jenny Zimmerman, who graciously gave me her, like, second choice leaves, because, you know, you took more than one, right?
Right.
And I said, please, can you help me? Because I gathered some, but most of them were from Jenny's extra bonus stash. So
I subcontracted.
I didn't pay.
Learning life lessons.
Yeah, well, okay, if you two guys are in the high country of computing, that kind of left me down in the swamp.
Very cool.
Yeah, in the chat, Curtis had mentioned a while back that he said PET was my first school experience as well. At that time, our entire public school division had only two computers, so they circulated a PET to school every 2 weeks. So that sounds sort of like,
yeah, this, similar,
sort of voyaging Apple II.
Past the computer. Yeah.
And that's still yeah, more computers than I had.
Yeah. Well, one thing one little comment that I wanted to make about my own background was that my sense was that a lot of times it depended on a single faculty member being just enthusiast. It's like, you know, some faculty member says, this is great, I'm going to do this, I'm going to show you guys this stuff. And it wasn't necessarily, it might have been, you know, like a history professor or you know, history teacher or whatever, but it, you know, it wasn't sort of like a school district curriculum kind of thing. It was kind of like somebody saw the value of this and put them in front of the kids. Mm-hmm. But, Carrington, what was it like in Canada land?
You didn't have computers. No, I'm kidding. My experience is really similar to a lot of you guys, with the PET being the first computer I had access to in any way in school. I was fortunate by that time, like a lot of people, I think, listen to this, like if you're a super computer person at the time, I was lucky to have a computer at home. Before this, I think it would be 1980 or 81 is my memory, because this would be grade 7, I think. I went to a thing called Highland Junior High. So up here we have junior high, which is grade 7, 8, 9. It's a middle school, some other places call it, I think. And in there was a, not really a computer lab, but there was one tiny room that had a PET computer in it. And at the time I had the TRS-80 at home, my Model 1, although at the time I just called it TRS-80, not a Model 1. But it's before I had a Cocoa or an Apple II. And it was amazing. Like, I thought it was the coolest looking computer I'd ever seen. And they built this screen and stuff. It looked like a full fancy computer. And my friend Samir and I would hang out in that room. And he knew more about this kind of computer than I did. He'd bring in cassettes of the games I remember playing Space Invaders on it. It was crazily cool. All because of him. And if we finished some in-class stuff early, then we could be released to the computer room. So kind of these things, like if you get good at math, then you get to have more access to the computer. For some people would see that a punishment, but I was like, yes, I will be as good at math as required. Please let me at the computer. It was like, it's like the dream thing for me. And I would prefer to be in that room over going to recess or whatever, but nobody else was interested. If I remember in those years, there was no computer actual class, unless it was being taught to like the grade 9s or something. So I was just in that room by myself 90% of the time. I would, like, Samir and I would hang out, or I'd go early to get access to it just to like play on the computer or type things, whatever. It was amazing. I wanted all the computer access all the time. Totally loved it. I took computer classes later in high school, but before that, and I don't even know what grade, the only thing I could take was a typing class. So I remember there's a big room, and so this is probably middle school as well, or junior high, and it was a big room with a giant electric typewriter on every desk. And so we learned typing. Mm-hmm. So I remember just F, F, F space, J, J, J space, learning about the home row, and typing, which, I mean, I became a touch typist really early, and that just paid off massive dividends going forward. So one of the best computer things I ever did was learn to become a touch typist. So hooray for that.
I did that also in high school. I took a touch typing class. And yeah. I remember it was mostly girls in the class, because most people thought of typing as a secretarial type of thing and not a thing that...
I don't remember what the mix was for me.
I wasn't the only boy. It wasn't quite like that. But I remember that, like, most of the content was girls who were thinking, I could use this if I'm going to get a job as a secretary kind of thing. And I was like, I want to be able to type faster on my computer. And
I just want to hear the keyboard.
FFFFJJJJ. And yep. I remember there was like audio we would type along with. I think we had like some tapes or records or something.
That's hilarious. Mm. I had the exact same experience.
I did typing as well, but again, not as advanced. They were not electric typewriters. It was a good old manual typewriter. And
so it's exercise as well.
I failed. It is. To this day, I can't touch type because as soon as I take my eyes off the keyboard, those keys move. Mm-hmm. Every time I take my eyes off the keyboard and those keys jump around and my typing becomes garbage on the screen. And when I look back down, the keys all jump back into their right place.
Something else might be going on.
Every keyboard in the world is out.
It's interesting. I tried to take a typing class. I mentioned that typing was one of the first things I did in the Apple, you know, in the Apple lab that popped up when I was in, you know, eighth grade. But people knew that I was like the computer guy, you know, like the teachers knew it, you know, because I talked about it a lot, which did wonders for my social situation. The guy that never stops talking about computers before they could possibly be cool or not. I remember talking to the middle school headmaster, and he said, "Well, don't you already type fast?" And I said, "Well, I mean, I do, but I don't, you know, do it properly. I use one finger on my right hand and then all these." And he said, "Well, type something." And so I typed something, and I was faster than anyone that finished the class before, so they wouldn't let me take it. He wouldn't let me take it. And so it was only when I got into mechanical keyboards, and there was this one that was exceptional, and it had blank keys. This was about 9 years ago, 8 years ago, that I really wanted. And I wanted the feel of I had these imported keycaps. It was like a $400 keyboard that's like, you know, less than a foot long. So I just downloaded whatever the first link was for free typing tutor. And I learned to touch type in about 2 weeks with that so that I could buy that keyboard and use it. So, yeah, it's strange. I only have been touch typing for, you know, well under 10 years.
Interesting. I like the idea that they wouldn't let you take the typing class because you were too good, like you were going to throw off the curve.
It wasn't like an official thing either, and it wasn't like he was like, "No, we can't." He sort of was pally with me. He's like, "No, this, you know, you don't need to do this. You're wasting time. Do take some other thing." He said, "You don't need to take that." And so, of course, I think if I had pushed it, but he didn't want me to do it, and he said, "Just, you know, why don't you take this class instead?" So I'm sure I could have, you know, but yeah. So I tried.
Yeah, it was definitely worth it. Though I think in the end to learn how to do that, I too was quite fast with my strange combination of four fingers. But I mean, you know, it just was nothing like what I was able to do later.
I think that really resonated with me, Paul, was something you said, that it was kind of having access to a computer in this certain range of years really depended on having a single faculty member being a computer enthusiast. And I'm almost certain that that's what happened in my school, that it was some teacher's pet that was in this room. It wasn't actually an official thing. I think it's just some person, like she just brought in her pet or something. Because around 1980, like this wouldn't have been like a new computer. Maybe it was somebody who got a second one or something, or who knows. It was maybe a hand-me-down thing. But I think that's why I got access, is some teacher who probably wasn't even teaching me just set it up in a room, and I got to, and it like was life-changing. So whoever that was, thank you, teacher.
Right. That's awesome.
Mm. I remember taking punch. The weird thing is, Michael, you had talked about punch cards, or Mark Sense cards. Yeah. I did that as well, which is weird. Like I don't remember when I did that. So this would be after probably early high school. So this is well after the computer revolution or whatever, having computers at home. And yet I remember taking a class where we had to fill out what we called punch cards, but were Mark Sense cards, where you just didn't actually punch. It's just anything that looks like that, I call a punch card to this day. Yeah. Punch, don't punch, whatever. You fill out with a pencil, still a punch card.
In 2B we trust.
Yeah, and I totally remember doing that. And we have to do the cards, and we'd hand them in, and we'd get back our printout. But it's weird. Like, that probably was the middle of the 80s or something. So I don't know why they're still using that tech. And, like, it's all such a jumble at this time of technology that's accessible.
Yeah. It's strange for them. It was 81 for me, which kind of makes sense. It was on the end of that sort of thing because, you know, there were floppy drives. I missed out on cassette tapes. I went straight from punch cards to floppy drives.
Nice.
The one thing I'll add, kind of tying off several of the things Carrington said, we had in that Apple lab I keep talking about, there was like a little back room that used to be, actually also was a closet at one point. It took some overflow Apple IIe's. I think there was like five in there. And at the end of the table was this TRS-80 Model 1 with the little interface box, you know, the interface box and the keyboard, the monitor.
Little.
Someone had given it, you know, someone had donated it, you know, and it was really not, there was no particular place for it in the program that was happening. So they just set it there, which they had to do because they were given that thing. I think there was also an Apple II Plus that was tossed in with the rest of the, with the other computers in that room because someone had given it. It actually had one of those big Apple graphic tablets, those huge Apple graphic tablets that was like the size of a table on that II Plus. But anyway, I would often type in programs from, I'd grab a magazine in the library and I would go, the other computers that would be used, I'd go type in at lunch some stuff on the Model 1. So that was my first time ever using, you know, a TRS-80, you know, Z80 system. And that was fun. It was black and white, but I dug it. Yeah, that was just an interesting little, you know, nothing much happened with that officially, but I actually, you know, got some enjoyment and actually learned some things by that having been given and put on that table. So
I'm surprised. One thing I'm surprised nobody's mentioned is, which I thought everybody else would talk about because I never had this experience as a kid and everybody else seems to, is playing Oregon Trail, which seems to be everybody's experience in school. And I never even heard of that thing until later in life.
No, I hadn't played Oregon Trail until Ken told us about that handheld. Oh. So I went and got, and then that handheld was only available in the US. So I got him to get me half a dozen of them. So I sort of got them to other people here. But no, Oregon Trail wasn't a thing here, apart from the fact you needed a computer to run it. But yeah, I checked with other younger persons who did have computers in school, and no, Oregon Trail just didn't seem to be a thing here. I don't know if it was because mech software wasn't on the curriculum or anything here, but it just didn't happen to be a thing. So maybe being a US-centric theme, it was US-centric.
Yeah, that one I think in particular. But yeah,
because I've been left with the impression in the last 20 years that like everybody but me played that thing when they were a kid.
Like, I will say, Carrington, never played it.
So it wasn't an Empire
I have never
thing.
Played it to this day.
Oh, okay. Ah, okay. A closet Empire.
Yeah. So Jack, did you?
I definitely played it, yeah. We had, that was one thing that we had that was on, yeah, every, that was kind of the standard. I think it felt like, as a child, like it felt like, you know, like Oregon Trail was the killer app for the Apple II. Like everyone who had an Apple II, including in the classroom, there was always Oregon Trail. There was an Oregon Trail floppy lying around, always. Mm. There was always...
Hashtag, you know, dysentery.
Because it was, I mean, ultimately, it was kind of fun to play, but it was also educational, so like nobody would object to it. But the other thing is that Jack and I are both relating experiences from the actual epicenter of mech.
Yes, we were in Minnesota.
You were the M of mech.
So in fact, mech had a big push to get Apple IIs in schools. I mean, like they bought Apple IIs for schools and provided, you know, it was actually sort of a state run thing for a while before they became a sort of a private company. So, so I think the reason that there were as many Apple IIs around as there were had to do with mech and the fact that Apple or Oregon Trail came with it. Right. Also. Mm. So.
Yeah. I remember it was sort of omnipresent, but I did not know it was a Minnesota thing until much more recently, like in the past 5 or 10 years. Like if I ever saw the name of the company, MECC, I didn't know what it stood for or give it any thought whatsoever.
Even despite the big shape of Minnesota that comes up at the beginning of the time?
I don't remember that.
Okay.
He's not good with shapes.
That's Minnesota.
All right. So, as anticipated, the time flew by, but I think maybe we can, I have some things I'll say next time because Earl has stuff to say. So,
okay. Yeah.
But maybe we can move on just to,
Next time I might drag out some of the, scanned stuff that I did that's particularly interesting sort of, along those lines, just to sort of go there. But, computers in schools, it definitely has changed.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I
But and I don't just mean the hardware. I mean the total concept. Even when computers were getting into the schools, I'm talking like late 80s, early 90s. Compared to now, it's just so totally different. Nephews and nieces, you know, relating about, to them, it's not computers in school anymore.
Oh, yeah, yeah, it's just school.
Yeah,
it's school.
Yeah, right. What you do. Yeah.
What did you do at school with this sort of stuff, Uncle Michael? Dream.
Yeah.
It kind of blows my, my daughter away that, like, the web became a thing that people knew about and could possibly access in the middle of my college years. I remember, seeing Mosaic, the browser, for the first time on a Sun.
Yeah.
And I think I've mentioned on the show before, it was some guy and his girlfriend were in front of it, and I was looking, I was in the lab doing work, looking across, and she said, "What is this thing?" He said, "Well, it's like Gopher, but for lazy people that like pictures." That's how the web was described.
That's about right.
It still is.
That's pretty much how I thought of it, too.
Yes, I will trumpet my windsock and agree with you.
I was, in the middle of college, in the lab, I remember the first moment I'd ever heard of or seen anything to do with the World Wide Web. And it was that. So, yes, it's now, all of these things I mentioned, like the Chromebook, the things my daughter's been doing since the fourth grade, it's all web-based,
In the comments, Al's got a definitely good point. Never understood why you had to be considered good at maths to use the computers. And I totally agree. I've always found that it's been more my language skills and art more than a science. To me, I make my living out of solving problems in computers, but I'm not the scientific approach guy. I'm the guy who treats computers as an art. I feel my way through problems. I'm sure there must be analytical processes going on behind the scenes. But, I totally agree with Al that I do understand it, but sort of like the assumption that you had to be good at maths to use computers. But I totally disagree. I know great guys who are great at maths, and those guys and gals are absolutely useless when it comes to programming. Get them to help me with a particularly tricky algorithm? Yes. Get them to write a complete program? I'll find them something else to do.
I think it's hilarious that you say, I solve problems with computers, but not using math. It's like, door won't stay open? I'll solve that problem with a computer. You need to prop up your desk? I'll solve that problem with a computer.
No, to me, so it's ill, but that's it. That the difficulty for me is that I go in, I find the problem, I fix the problem, and then I've got to explain to someone, how did you do that? How did you find the problem? I said, well, I found it. I went through the code, and we had people doing all of the full debugging and everything. They couldn't find it. I go in and I sort of like mull around in it, and I go, have a look at this here. Is this what you're really intending to do? So it's not really the best approach. And so I'm trying to find the words to tell them what's wrong with what they've done. But for me, it's all just patterns and shapes and concepts all whirling around. And I've got to sort of relate it back into numbers and physical things. And I think I'll just stick to my arty way of doing things.
Well, I have sort of thought of this. Thought has come to me a couple of times that when I'm working, because I, like all of us, I think, we do program now, and something doesn't work, and when it doesn't work, there is a kind of just intuition, like you see what happens and you realize that seven steps back there was a thing that could have yielded that result, even though it's not quite clear from looking at it that it would have landed there. But like you've gotten this sort of expert system going where like you can recognize that pattern and just intuit I need to look in this seven steps back spot because that's going to be where the problem was.
The same thing with doing write-ups and documentation and whatnot before we had proper on-screen word processing. I had no problems at all with typing up codes and with all the GML labels and things that go with it. And, I had that, I wrote the document and my full WYSIWYG was in my head. I could actually, you know, I'd type, you know, colon H1 and in my mind I know that I was sort of going into a heading and I could visualize the entire pages. And it literally was as if I moved through the text, I'd almost see a page flip in my mind as I went to the next page. And I do my programming works the same way. I'm typing the program and both what I'm typing is going into my head to see it running, and I'm also seeing it running and pulling that down onto the keyboard. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's the best way I can describe the way that I handle computers. And, I've sort of like, I've always wondered, like, are there other strange people out there that program and create in that same manner as a two-way dialogue between keyboard and their mind? But I think we're getting away from it. But, yeah, it's... Mm-hmm. From the topic, but
it is off topic, but it's also very interesting. And I think this also correlates to, like, these days in software development, there's a lot of stuff about architectural patterns. If you're building a mobile app, it's like, oh, are you doing Viper? Are you doing MVVM? There are these different sort of acronyms that describe different ways of laying out your classes and dividing up your code.
Oh, God, don't get me started with acronyms.
Acronyms,
now. I can't stand them.
Once you get acronyms into computing, it's all a downhill from there. But I feel like
FLI,
and these
FLI.
You know, these approaches can be good ways to like sort of formalize an approach to something. But when it becomes a recipe that people try and follow in a rote manner, then they're not really learning how the system works or how things are really interacting. It's more just like, oh, well, I know that if I'm fetching these things from a database, I'm going to display them, then I must first put them into this type of object, and they must be transformed into this thing, and then that must become the view. Like, it's like, yeah, that is a way to do it, but if you haven't sort of built like a couple dozen different ways of all the things that you try out by intuition to get to that point yourself, then you don't really even understand. Yeah, so it's like you're saying you have an intuitive approach, like, because you know, you feel sort of in your gut, like, yeah, I recognize the situation, rather than it's not, oh, I'm following what I saw in a blog post about how to code this thing. Mm-hmm. You've got some knowledge, and you know, again, not to you know, totally crap on, you know, codifying an architecture and trying to have things that are repeatable and usable, but it's kind of like there's something there with like. There is an adage around this that I don't recall the details of, but like something about like learning rules for how to do something is, that's kind of like, you know, if we're talking about going from a novice to an intermediate to a journeyman to an expert, like using rules for how to do something is novice intermediate level sort of stuff, because eventually you get to a point where these rules, I've either internalized them or I haven't, and if I haven't, it's because maybe for me they're not the right rules anyway. And so, like, once you're expert at something, you are going based on the approach that you know in your gut, and you don't even have to think about it in a way.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I think I've related stories and things in the past where I've, sort of, like, dealt with IBM guys, and they said, oh, no, you can't do that. Then basically I go away and... I do it, and I give it back to them, and they go, oh, there's nothing in the manuals that tell you to do that. And I said, well, there's nothing in the manual that said I couldn't.
Nothing in the rules says a horse can't play football.
I just threw things together, you know, even just down under the drawing thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But
the thing you're talking about with rules and experts and things like that is sort of the basis of like the original kind of work on neural nets and expert systems. You know, they were basically trying to do things like replicate what like a doctor's diagnosis might be. You know, like you have a set of symptoms and you have a set of rules that kind of tell you like what you do with those symptoms, but an actual doctor who's been practicing for a while will not use those rules. They will just kind of know the answer, and the neural net was trying to kind of like
simulate that way of learning something. Of having a bunch of inputs over and over again, seeing where you end up, and is it right or wrong?
It's always lupus
that way.
I can envision them trying to create a neural network of the way I work, and then I can just see the computer just screaming no, and then just like slumping into a pile of
melted
circuits.
Maybe that's why your keyboards keep moving around. The computer's fighting you. No, stop typing, Michael. Stop it.
Right.
You're messing with forces you don't understand.
So, all right. Maybe we'll continue. We'll continue with the topic of computers in school next time. I think
computers in school and tangents.
And tangents, yes. And let's see. I think I'll mention a couple of feedback things before we move on to the items of interest in the news. So one thing that we got was Spectron on Twitter posted a link to a BBC archive. Well, BBC archive themselves have a Twitter account and they're posting things. And recently they posted a link to a 1986 behind the scenes Infocom video where they went and talked to the people who like wrote the Infocom games. And that's pretty cool. So check that out. Check out the BBC archives generally, check out their computer section, but that one in particular is also. Oh, and so we've talked, I think, a couple of times about this series of articles by Aaron A. Reed, the 50 years of text.
So good. Gosh, it's so good.
Yeah. So there's a recent one, and I think we'll have to probably save talking about it till next time. But Spectron also pointed us to another article in the series, which is on the game Silver Wolf, but really basically about the games mistresses of St. Bride's School. So that will probably become a topic here next time, is my guess. But and I also was wondering about whether Aaron A. Reed is using the A specifically so that it can be Aaron A. Reed on various topics, which if you spell it out, turns out to be Aaron. But anyway, the last thing I guess I wanted to mention was so on the Facebook page, I think just today, somebody posted a question about getting Perestroika to run in English, this Prestava game that we talked about, from, you know, sort of sourced from that same Aaron A. Reed site. And there are on the site there, you know, in the write-up, there are translated screenshots, the original game's in Czech. And but it turns out, I think, that the game is still being translated. Like, it's not actually quite finished. But somebody picked that up. So Jim Gary picked it up and ported it to the MC-10. And you can play it on an emulator. So even though it isn't the actual, it's not sort of like the official port, in a sense, you know, to the extent that there is an official port, there is a way to play it. So we'll have a link there. But what you basically do is, you go to Jim Gary's emulator site, and there you pick the Prestav B cassette and type run, and then you can see it go.
So amazing.
And it does, you know, what does it say? I can't quite read it, but, you know, like Perestroika, path to communism, and you do things. There's a box you can open and look into, and it does indeed, you know, repeatedly give you slogans. It's hilarious.
I could just see a U.S. implementation of this with political slogans.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's political satire right through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Curtis notes in the chat that Jim ports everything to the MC-10. He has got a very nice MC-10 simulator. So anything that you can sort of type into BASIC and run on an MC-10, Jim will do that. So,
hell, why not?
Yes, indeed. No, that's pretty cool. I mean, like, it's neat to see the kind of oversized love for the MC-10. Yeah. In a sense, and it's going to if I have time to talk about it, I will talk about something sort of similar that I ran across too. But okay, anyway, that'll do it for the feedback at the moment, and we can now turn to the items of interest in news, and Blake has the first of these.
Okay, well, you know, I'm an Amiga guy. I think some of us have, you know, had time with Amigas here. I remember using version 1.0 of the Kickstart and Workbench, and, you know, moving up through the different, you know, versions 1.2, 1.3, and then in the early 90s systems came out that got all the way up, the early 90s to Amiga OS 3.1 with the Amiga, you know, 1200, the 4000, and it's everything sort of stopped there, you know, for quite a few years. What's happened is Amiga OS 3.2 has just been released. Like Commodore, like Atari, you know, has the assets of the company, you know, when, of course, they went bankrupt in 94. Their different companies have, you know, bought and had the rights to different parts of the technologies. Around 1999, Hage, if I may be pronouncing that, H-A-A-G-E, Hage and partner. They owned the tech. They had access to the early versions of the OS, and so they did a 3.5 to 3.9 update, which was, you know, basically, you know, drivers for, you know, GUI enhancements, TCP stacks. It's kind of a, people have mixed feelings about it because some find it less of a pure thing than using the previous 3.1. Anyway, Hyperion came in at some point and through various, you know, court situations became the owners of the technology. A few years ago, I think they've sort of backstepped from this other company's 3.5, 3.9, and they were looking at 3.1, and a little update about 2 years ago came out, 3.1.4. I guess 3.1.3 was the previous version, and they added some quality of life things. So that was notable in that it was a upgrade that hadn't happened, you know, since, you know, the early 1990s from officially, you know, who it is that is Amiga now. Sort of. It's kind of like Atari, like I say. It's I myself can't keep track of it, and I actually don't really even want to fully. but they own the 3.5 and 3.9 source code, it appears, that the other company, you know, created and released. But they, you know, again, they're kind of going back to the original. And what they've done is they've come out with 3.2, and it has a the quality of life improvements. Well, it has many. There's interface enhancements. There's a list of 100, basically 100 features that have been added, which is pretty impressive. I mean, it has all of the, you know, 3.1.4 features that came out, you know, like a year or two ago, and they actually created a new ROM that contained some of the when 3.1.4 came out that. I think it was twice the size. You had to modify your board, I think, in order to, with some slight modification, to use it. I don't believe you were required to have it, but it saved memory if you did. And I don't think 3.2 requires that ROM. But there, you know, there's native support for, you know, PNGs, JPEGs in the OS. You know, click on them. There's built-in viewers, which, you know, seems obvious. But again, you know, like the last major release was however many decades ago it was. There are improved icons, there's changes to the window manager, high customizations, and of course they work with retargetable graphics if you have a slotted Amiga, or even if you don't have a slotted Amiga within devices that we talked at some length about several episodes ago. Anyway, it's viewed now, and it wasn't clear to me when I first saw this, but it seems that, you know, 3.1 to 3.2 is a bigger deal and more changes than, you know, this, you know, 3.1 to 3.9 that came out from the other company, you know, in 99. So it's a very significant upgrade, and there's information on Hyperion Entertainment's website. You can, you know, place an order. The price varies, I think, depending on where you are. I don't actually have the price in front of me. 3.2. Okay, here from this one source, it's $49.99 US, which, you know, is small potatoes for someone that's an Amiga enthusiast and actually, you know, uses and wants to take advantage of some of these improvements. But it seemed you know, a rather notable occurrence in the Amiga world. I mean, if I actually have physical Amigas, I want to look at, you know, compatibility, but I have an Amiga 2000 that's accelerated mildly, you know, very low-level accelerator, but, you know, it seems like it might be a great deal of fun to, you know, install it. It'll install over the OS. You don't have to gut everything, you know, just to spend some time with it. It might motivate me to expand the thing again, and, you know, video card, that sort of thing. So that's a pretty big deal for Amiga people, and it's kind of cool that, you know, officially the company that's official owners of the tech is has put this out, and, you know, has apparently extensive online documentation in the OS is present. It's just equal to hundreds of pages of documentation. People, you know, talk about the quality of it. Yeah, and I think, you know, looking, I keep drawing the parallel with Atari. I think Amiga. And again, I have both Ataris and Amigas. This, you know, I've been in those wars back in the 90s, you know, Atari versus Amiga, which is better. Well, I know which is better. But anyway, I think Atari as a company, quote unquote, is more of a hot mess than Amiga. You know, like even though Amiga doesn't really exist, I think Atari seems to be more of a strange incarnation of whatever it might be. So not that that's salient to this conversation, but I've been going back and forth, so I thought I'd give my take on that. But anyway, so that's all I've got of items and interesting news. It works great in emulation. I think most people that I hear looking at on, you know, Hacker News comments, they're running it on emulation. You know, I guess that makes sense. There's more people running emulated Amigas than Amigas, but it works great with that. But it also works great on even the base, like an Amiga 500 can run this, you know, with certain pretty reasonable requirements. So, and that's what I got there.
Cool.
Cool.
I'm not an Amiga user, so I have a really basic Amiga question to see if I'm right about something. Is it the case that there's Amiga OS 3 point whatever and Amiga OS 4 point whatever, and the 3 is for the 68K computers and the 4 is for the PowerPC? Am I right in my head that that's the case?
Yes. Yes. So the same company, I think the first thing, I believe I'm looking at a timeline that I'm just seeing in the comments on Hacker News, Hyperion, who is the company that put out this, you know, they're focusing now on this 3.1 was the last thing Commodore put out, you know, and back in, you know, 1992 or whatever, 91 or whatever. And there was like, you know, in between there was 2.0, you know, but whatever, we ended up at 3.1. What people started doing, because, you know, Dave Haney, who developed, you know, a great percentage of the Amiga, engineered a lot of the Amiga hardware, commented on this, and the situation was that, I guess, because Apple went from 68,000 to PowerPC, you know, around the time the Amiga was just ending, people started building accelerators. Commodore never did this, but third parties started building accelerators for the Amiga that were PowerPC based. And the Amiga OS 4 was written to run only on these Amigas that had PowerPC accelerators in them. So they'd run much faster. It was an expanded version. Like they took 3.1, you know, the code, and then, you know, moved it forward in certain ways. But they were targeting a much higher power system. PowerPC, you definitely were going to have a graphics card, like a, you know, a Radeon something, you know, that kind of thing. And it went, yeah, there's 4.0, 4.1, and that still is maintained and people still run it. And companies have started putting out PowerPC boards that will run it, you know, like a whole system. I have one. It's called a SAM 440 Flex is the version I have. It's basically like a, you know, officially it's like a Linux. Here's a PowerPC board that's generic and runs Linux, but it also runs Amiga OS 4. Like that's what it is. There's not a whole lot of these things that are getting sold. That's what Amiga OS 4 targets. It targets these standalone PowerPC systems, and it also targets Amiga systems that have PowerPC accelerators in them, which were the first PowerPC things. The same company is now backed up, and they're now pushing all these new things forward, but they are targeting the 68,000 based, you know, yes. So it's sort of like extending what was going on in the early 90s, as if those machines, the PowerPC never happened, as if that never happened. I don't believe, and I could be wrong about this, it's a lot of bullet points, I don't think that, you know, they're trying to merge. I don't think this 3.1 will run natively on PowerPC. I think 4 is still there, it's still sold, it's still being maintained, theoretically. Yeah, so there are two branches, I think, and they're calling it, I see there's a distinction, Hyperion is calling this, what's just happened with 3.2, the classic branch. And then there's the previous, the PowerPC branch. But the, just in closing that lengthy answer to your question, Dave Haney, who was the engineer, said, you know, why these people didn't use commodity Intel hardware as the, you know, the alternative, like the new platform. Now, like PowerPC, it's much more expensive, and especially today, it's so obscure. You know, like there aren't any consumer machines that are using PowerPC. If you could just throw the absolute weakest Intel or AMD chip, you know, into a case and run Amiga OS 4 on it, like it would be almost free, you know, like there would be no hardware cost, but that's not the case. If you want to buy you have to pay thousands of dollars if you want to buy a fast PowerPC board that'll basically only run Amiga OS4, and then Linux if you want to, but that's an expensive Linux machine. Yeah, so it's a weird choice. I think they must have done it because, you know, if Apple went from 68,000 to PowerPC, then it must be, you know, and it was Motorola to Motorola, you know, so it felt sort of good, I guess, but I don't know. It's a weird history.
So would I be able to run that on one of my slightly surplus G3 or G4 Macs?
You can run, you can't, there are, and this is where, like, I'm only so deep into this. There are, I think it might be possible that there are some Mac, the Mac Mini jumps to mind, like a G4 Mini. I believe it might be possible to run Amiga OS 4 on it, but one of the things that is, I think this doesn't do any favors to the Amiga people. There are two Amiga-compatible OSs that are competing with OS 4 in the PowerPC space. They've split it. So literally, so okay. And some of those, like it runs, you know, Amiga software. Some of those, like it's MorphOS and...
I think that might be the one I was thinking of, yeah.
And AROS, Amiga... replacement operating system, I think, but one of those two, and I can't remember, I think it's MorphOS, will run on a number of PowerPC Macs, and I think it'll run on one. I have, you know, I have a like a G4 tower sitting behind me. I believe it'll run on it, but again, it's not the official Amiga OS 4. MorphOS was created as something that ran on systems that would run Amiga OS 4 one day, but the OS 4 hadn't yet been released, so it's like sort of a bridge.
Okay. Yeah, I was asking from the, because I'm currently demacking a G4 MacBook, and I'm putting Linux PPC on it. So
I think it's very likely that you could run, and MorphOS is free, I believe. One of them is not. AROS, I think, is not, and that's Intel based. Anyway. Actually, it's multi-platform. Yeah,
another
time.
Yeah.
But I'm not positive. It could be that Amiga OS 4 won't run on any Mac, but not on many if it does.
Well, it sounds interesting, so I might have to go get the appropriate hardware, maybe.
Sure. Yeah, it's fun to play with. I have like Amiga OS 4 feels you know pretty modern, and it looks nice. But also, you know, it feels less like an Amiga because it's, you know, it's not actually an Amiga.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm going to probably get a lot of hate responses for some of the opinions that I've shared. Yeah. But anyway.
Let's see. We can move on to the next thing now. It has little to do with the Amiga. Carrington has the next one.
I do. Oh, I do. Yes, and I'm sharing a screen. So this will be a quick one. I thought this was really interesting. So it's an MIT Technology Review. If you are not a subscriber to that, be aware they only let you view a couple of free things. So if you go to a link to this, then they'll say, okay, you're down to two more free things. So you better really want to watch this thing. But this is about the creation of Chinese characters in vintage computers and what led to the modern state for Chinese characters. Because unlike English characters and or like Western characters and things that are very easy to put into a 9x9 grid, essentially, these are too detailed. And so this is about a process from 40 years ago where a fellow named Bruce Rosenblum used an Apple II to start creating Chinese characters for a computer that didn't get released. It was called the Sinotype 3. Never got commercially released, but this was one of the first times where somebody was trying to create a giant set, like 3,000 characters or so, for Chinese characters so you could have them on a computer. So I used a thing called Gridmaster and just started creating a font. So it was him and a bunch of people. And they decided to use a 16 by 16 grid, so 0 through F in hex, giving you 256 different dots, or as this article puts it, 256 separate decisions they had to make, one for each dot. It is written for somebody who doesn't know what a bitmap is. It's a very accessible, high-level view of this, but I found it an interesting read, mostly because it's got some great shots of developing for the Sinotype and various characters, and some interesting insight into some strange approaches they take that have resonated through to modern characters, it seems, according to this article. So there's some really nice images of them doing the various what they call radicals. So a radical is a part of a character that can get reused in things. So in Chinese, you might have the radical for woman, and that might appear in a lot of characters. And so you would think, if you think like a programmer, you think, great, I will create the little bitmap radical for woman, and then any character that needs that, we can just import that little bit and overlay it on my grid and use it. And the person heading up this said, no, that's going to not be accurate enough and not have the beauty of the way we want it to appear. So we have to recreate that radical every single time, depending on how it's being used. So like down here, for instance, here's an example of a radical character being used, and it's very slightly edited for the way it appears in three different characters to make it more aesthetically pleasing and to fit better rather than a cookie cutter approach. Was this the best approach? I don't know. It took so long to get done, then it never got finished in time for the computer. The computer never got released. So maybe it was a bad choice from an economic standpoint, but an interesting approach from a love of fonts standpoint. So it's a really neat article, and it talks about like some ideas that really only come up if you're generating a font and what would be involved in it. And this is using very old technology. This is back from the 80s when they made this. And nowadays on much higher resolution screens, a lot of the issues here wouldn't be issues nowadays. But it's interesting the decisions they had to make. And this is a nice, very high-level review of the creation of different characters for a language that I'm not familiar with at all, and kind of like what they came up with. I found it super interesting. So if you're interested in fonts, you're interested in how other languages or other computers would handle these things, this is a nice, very accessible article. So it's an MIT review. It could be one of your three choices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it falls right into what I'm currently working with at the moment. From an aesthetics and understanding point of view, I've just acquired a KEC-i computer, yeah. A Chinese education computer, and it switches between the standard, the Apple clone. So it switches between Chinese characters and also the standard character set. So and I've also just recently received a bag of 18 books from mainland China from that period for the computer. So I'll be scanning those, and I have absolutely no skill in reading Chinese, but I'm happy to scan the books and get them up on the internet. It's just pages of stuff that I just look at it from a point of view of scan quality rather than read. Well, it's, as long as the quality is there, it's readable. But yeah, this is great. And yeah, I remember working with back in the early 80s with a guy in the computer lab, and he was not as detailed approach as this, but he was doing a simplified Chinese tutoring package written on the Apple II. And we would sit down for ages. I was basically helping him from a artistic viewability point of view of displaying the characters and building the characters on the high-res display of the Apple II Plus. And yeah, this is bringing back quite a lot of good memories.
That's glad. It's good that they're good.
Yeah. Oh, well, retro computing, all retro computing is good. All languages. So this is just a different bent on the language. Normally, when we speak of languages, we speak of programming languages. But this is a retro computer memory of language that is a little bit different from most.
It is pretty amazing that now it is quite possible to take a phone and point it at one of these things, and the phone will tell you it says.
Well, I literally did that with the computer after I received it. I took it to one of our local meetups, and we had two RCA plugs on the back, conveniently labeled, telling us exactly what they were, just that no one there could read Chinese. Right. So yeah, got the phone out and brought up Translate, pointed at it, and one ended up saying monitor, and the other one ended up saying TV. So as you said, it's amazing what we can now do with those mobile phone thingies, and And that internet thing as well is pretty handy too.
My girlfriend's job has her go to Singapore quite a bit. And so she has a mug that she brought home from Singapore with a really nice picture on the front and some Chinese characters on the back, because she had no idea what it says. And so just a couple of weeks ago, we used the Translate to look at it. And because it's kind of handwritten, it's almost like a cursive thing. It just comes up with a different phrase every single time. Yeah. My favorite of which was, eight is also a mountain. So I now think that is what that means, and I love it. So we call that mug now, eight is also a mountain.
Oh, it's reaching the high points of 8-bit computing. Right. Yes.
That's awesome.
Yeah. But yeah, you do actually get that when you're I love how when you're using translate and you're parsing it over the text, and the translation literally changes before your eyes as it's bringing, as it's losing characters, bringing in characters. You do same sort of thing when I will cut and paste into a window for translating and just trying to narrow down exactly the bit that I need. And so you trim a bit off the left, trim a bit off the right, and your translation in the translation window is sort of like, put that character back.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to build up, because I'm heading to pages of the manual where I can see the diagrams and I get the feel that it's the bit of information that I'm trying to track down about the computer, and then progressively translating sentences and paragraphs to get the information, then basically cutting, pasting that back into a document so I can sort of like have a English synopsis of the manual and the information so that I can then post that up for other people, because I know there's quite a few people who are now getting their hands on these computers from the 80s out of, I call it my little red apple from Little Red China. So.
Excellent. All right. And speaking of little things,
yes,
you have the next thing.
Yeah, okay. Amazingly, it's a book. So the book that I'm bringing to people's attention is The Little Book of Sound Chips. This is volume 1, 1977-81. Though there is one machine that is missing from there. I can't see the Apple with its one-bit speaker and the amazing quality of sound that you can produce by toggling that speaker. It's wasting its time on all these systems that actually play music. But the PDF is currently available for £10. And you can get into pre-ordering a hard copy. So I'm trying to decide whether to get the PDF and then the hard copy, or just go and risk ordering the hard copy and just going straight for that. But I love these books that have been coming out. It's authors and writers that I have been following for other topics, and the screenshots that I've seen of the artwork in there in itself, it's just a superb presentation. So it's got arcade machines and as well as your desktop computers of the day. So they say it's a curated experience of the chips, stories behind the chips, how they were used, how were they abused. And sort of it looks very interesting. And so if you're after a different bent on retro computing, I think volume one is worth a go to then sort of like see if you want to follow up on any more. So
cool.
As I said, it's just something different. Not from these guys. I've just recently bought a hard copy of War of the Worlds. That was, again, I bought it for the artwork, and I know the story back to front, various implementations of it, but I just love these books, just the feel of books. So I think I will just risk going straight to the book rather than the PDF, but others there who don't quite have the same fascination for slaughtered sheets of tree flesh.
I prefer to buy something on Kindle, and then I just go out to the woods and I just kill a couple of trees.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. Same result.
Just for that, I could loan you a chainsaw. Pop over and we can just go down the back and have a chainsaw each and just go Kindle-ize a couple of trees.
Also, I'd like to point out that Brandon in the chat is killing me. It's so funny. So my girlfriend, she lives in Canada, you wouldn't know her. Oh, she's again. Oh, wait, no, she's in Singapore now.
Yeah.
All very pleasant.
That's gold, Brandon. Yep. Thank you. Yes, the Canadian girlfriend. Yeah, it's a meme.
Okay, so I have my thing here. So my thing started off. We talked about this. Came up actually just right in the comments, actually at the end last time, that. And I still don't actually know how to pronounce his name, but still I'm going to say Vogt.
I vote for Vogt.
Okay.
I Vogt? Vote for Vogt. Okay.
Like John Voight, except missing the I, because there's no I in Voight.
Maybe he's got a patch.
Yes.
Possibly it.
We'll patch that.
Anyway, we apologize.
No, we don't.
But anyway, so just at the time of recording last time, Stefan released a director's cut of Hibernated 1. It is a downloadable game. You can download it now. It's a sort of a remastering of a adventure game, a sort of Infocom type adventure game called Hibernated 1 that was out for a number of platforms before. This has been retooled. It is available for a bunch of different platforms. It's been basically rewritten in Punion form, which has come up a couple of times. And actually, I think it also exists in a modern form, using something called Parchment. If you look at the systems that it's available on, so available for Commodore 64, Amstrad CPC, and PCW, Spectrum Plus 3, Spectrum Next, many, many things, MS-DOS, OL2, BBC Micro, Dragon 64, MSX 1, 2, Oric, TN-94A, and the SAM Coupe. I thought, the SAM Coupe? Like, what is the SAM Coupe? I don't know. I was looking up some other stuff, and I was trying to look up Punion form, and I landed on pony information instead. So there's a picture of the queen riding a pony. here's Hibernated 1. Director's cut for the SAM Coupe, it's possible to pre-order this. You can't order it yet, or you can pre-order it, but it's not out yet. It'll be out, I think, in August. But it comes in a box that's like the Infocom gray boxes. Mm-hmm. It looks really nice. And there's a different box for each platform. This one, you can see there's a little sticker on the bottom. This one is for the MGT SAM Coupe. But there's different versions for all the different computers. So it's available on polyplay.xyz. You can pre-order them for whatever your favorite platform is. The SAM Coupe. I did not know what a SAM Coupe is.
Never heard of it before.
No, I know. I hadn't either. But apparently it is. It's sort of like a ZX Spectrum development. So it's from Miles Gordon Technology. It's supposed to be something that would be sort of like the next step in the ZX Spectrum line. It's not from Sinclair, but that's what it was targeting. So it's shaped in a way that's supposed to be reminiscent of like a sports car or something like that. It's got these little things on the side that are sort of like
coupe
wheels.
In the name.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, so when I, already that was weird to me because I thought, a coupe, it's an abbreviated car, right? it's like a car that is cut. And, I didn't think of it as a sports thing at all. I thought of it as just like, like a sedan, but apparently that among the people for whom this was, targeting, this apparently meant something sort of sporty. So anyway, this is the SAM Coupe. This is I have an eBay auction up of one that's already been sold, but it's sold for about £1,000 pounds. So they're pretty rare apparently. But so had you guys heard of this computer? This
never SAM Coupe? Flew never. Completely under my radar.
Subscribe to Retro Gamer Magazine, which is a UK publication that I've had for like 15 years. They do talk about it when they talk about ports. That's one of the things. So only through there have I ever heard of it. It's a very
strange
looking
machine. I thought you were going to say you subscribe to SAM Coupe magazine. Like, come on.
Yeah.
I'm the Alexandria chapter president of the SAM Coupe fan club.
I'm holding
so far,
up for the four floppy SAM sedan.
So far, it's only me. But we're trying to get more.
Yeah. Fun. it sort of struck me as strange when I saw that, it was available on this new game was available on the Sam Coupe, and so I thought, all right, well, I wanted to see what that was. None are currently for sale. One was for sale a little while ago. There are a couple of YouTube overviews. So Re-Enthused did a sort of a hardware overview of the stuff that it includes. It's basically it has higher speeds and it has slightly better design ports. It has the ability to have 3.5-inch floppies and things like that. And so you can learn a little bit about these. It runs Spectrum games. Here's on the screen. I have a Prince of Persia. This one I think actually written specifically for the Sam Coupe.
With a very white blonde Prince of Persia.
Yeah.
It's an odd choice for the Prince of Persia there.
Yeah. On eBay, you can find an Ethernet and SD card solution for your Sam Coupe.
Crazy.
Again, it's like, I feel like I stepped into an alternate universe.
I'm maybe being punked. You guys are trying to convince me this thing exists and it's going to come up later and I'll talk about it like it's real. And you're like, aha, we fooled you.
Yeah, it's amazing. It does seem like they're this is out there and people are enthusiastic about it.
I can't wait for CoupeCon next year when that comes back.
Yeah.
I just love the webpage.
Yeah, so at samcoupe.com is actually sort of the home site of Quasar, they are the makers of many of these hardware pieces, so the Z-Executor that will help you run ZX Spectrum things, the Trinity Ethernet thing that I was just talking about, and they also are the place where the current home of Sam Revival magazine, which is next issue is going to be issue number 26 that's coming up. You can buy them. They're in print only. They don't exist as PDFs. You just buy them. They ship anywhere. If you back issues are possible, you can pre-order issue 26. It says it's due in March. I don't think it's actually out yet, but for £10. So again, the universe is still, we're still in that alternate universe. Here's a picture of the magazine, the number two, the most recently published magazine, number 25. So you can get that. You can buy that. In fact, actually, it's the eBay seller is Quasar itself. You can get that for £10. There's some YouTube demonstrations so this, I don't know if we have come across this YouTuber before, TJ Ferreira. So I've seen his unboxing of a ZX Spectrum, Spectrum Next, one of the new things. He also has Sam Coupe. And so he's got some videos about that and a particular video that's about these magazines, because he's delighted to see that there still are these magazines. They recently come with cover discs. So he booted up. You can see in the video, his Sam Coupe back there. It really does look like a little car.
The wheels.
but he boots up the cover discs and tries them out on his Sam Coupe. So
I think I'm going to come down hard on not believing this exists. I think he's in on it, and
it
that
just
is
seems
a
like a really long
call. And I don't think you're ever going to convince me this is a real computer. No, I won't fall for your japes. Your jocularity. I think you're all trying to pull one over on me, and this is nonsense. That's a render, not a computer. This doesn't exist. No, I say no.
Yeah. It does
nice
seem,
try.
It does seem crazy.
You're calling shenanigans.
I totally call. I'm going to pick up the phone, and I'm going to telephone my friend Shenanigans and tell him all about what you're trying to do. I say no. So, I say it doesn't exist. Wikipedia is easy to edit, so I don't care that it's a Wikipedia article. No, it's a deep fake of another computer. It doesn't exist. No, I refuse. I refuse. Okay. Here and now I state I will forever refuse to acknowledge that the Sam Coupe did or does exist. No.
Carrington takes a strong stand.
Takes a strong stance that is nonsense. No way this thing exists.
I think one of the things that was weird about it, and the people mention this kind of frequently, is that it came out in 1989. And this is 1989 is basically a point when making an 8-bit computer based on a Z80 is not as crazy. So
it doesn't feel like the peak year for the Z80.
No.
No.
Yeah. I used to do a podcast called No Quarter. We talked about an arcade game called Story Charlie, and this is the Story Charlie of,
you're
of
right.
retro computers. No, yeah. I don't believe. Yes, it came out in 1989. Right, sure it did. Whatever.
So, if you wanted to simulate this nonsense computer, you can run Sim Coupe. This is the this is basically the standard Sim Coupe emulator.
Oh, that's a good name.
So, and there's you know, sort of directions how you can run it. It exists in a lot of different platforms.
I see that SAM is an acronym for Some Amazing Micro, according to Wikipedia.
Is it really? Oh, yeah. I didn't know that.
Some Amazing Micro. That's some amazing micro you've got there.
It seems even less likely to be real. But anyway, yeah. So you can download Sim Coupe, the SAM Coupe emulator.
Ooh, I totally want to run this on my OS2 warp machine.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It has a wide range of things that it runs on. Although
it runs
does,
on Amiga OS 4.
That's wild.
Perfect. Yeah. And yeah. So and I did in fact download it. You know, and I did and did make it run. And so if you want to make it run on like at least a Mac like the one I have, M1 Mini, you have to hit F8 to take it full screen and then F8 back out before you'll see anything. For some reason, it like the screen looks dead until you're full screen. And once you are full screen once, then you can come back and then you can see it. But anyway, yeah. So let's see. There's so if you want, let's see. There's a world of sam.org. Which has all this, you know, picture of the thing and a bunch of software for it, and it's basically like a place that collects together software.
No, nah, this is an AR game for some upcoming movie. Like, no, nope. I just say no. I say no to all of it.
Yep. And I guess the last thing to mention is the Sam Coupe Champion Collection on archive.org. Mm. I mean, now that this idea has been planted, that it's all just fake, it's hard to not view it through that lens. But
if you're a devotee and a faithful user of this machine, are you known as a son of Sam? Or
yes,
I'm not sure that I hope so. Anyway, this was my adventure. I was originally going to talk about the release of Hibernated 1, the director's cut, and I just fell down this long set of rabbit holes.
That started with pony information. Hilariously.
Yeah, we saw the queen on a pony. Yeah.
That's right.
Yes.
This all feels like a dream right now.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. I feel like so that was my time.
That was my item of interest and or news.
Excellent.
And so now, a word from our sponsor.
This season on Miracle Workers, a devout reverend.
Oh, devout and neurotic. Don't forget that.
A young woman constrained by society.
I just want to party. Is that so wrong?
Her wealthy husband.
I've got the biggest wagon on the trail.
A bloodthirsty bounty hunter.
Sup.
And a notorious outlaw.
Notoriously handsome.
Together, braving the Oregon Trail. What could go wrong?
Ow! Quite a lot, apparently.
A new adventure awaits. Miracle Workers, Oregon Trail, premiering July 13th on TBS.
Do you like it?
Do I like it? I love it. Is it really a prime computer?
Do you know about them?
Know about them? I've seen them on Gallifrey in the constellation of Cerberus. Ha ha! At last, I'm up to date.
Would you like to be introduced? Hmm? It's terribly interactive.
Interactive? You mean immediate response?
Immediate.
Okay, Prime. How long's my scarf?
Well, it's not that impressive.
What? In 7 computer languages and 5 protocols.
Protocols?
Yes. That's how it talks to other computers.
It talks to other computers?
Well, of course it does. It's a prime. You're going to be all right, kid.
And we're back. All right, so the host's retrocomputing gift idea today was something Carrington found. So, I don't know, Carrington, perhaps you want to say something about it.
I don't remember finding this. What is... Oh, yeah, just a Radio Shack shirt. So if you want to be like Jerry Ellsworth, and all of us should be, you can get yourself a white logo on red shirt Radio Shack t-shirt from Radio Shack. Now, Radio Shack is, like many companies we talked about today, you know, the company currently using the words Radio Shack. but one can make that argument about every computer company as well, even Apple. Like, they aren't, none of them are really the computer they used to be, the company they used to be. But these are cool. So it's official Radio Shack with the classic Radio Shack funky logo, which I've always really liked. $24, and it comes from RadioShack.com. So you get yourself a cool, the white on red is the classic look. So if you want to pretend to be a Radio Shack employee, that's the one to get.
Right. Mm. So what is walking around saying? So do you want to buy a cell phone?
A flip phone?
You've got questions. Yeah, we've got cell phones.
You've got questions? Heck, we've got questions.
I do think, actually, though, that it's very nice that it's coming from Radio Shack. Like, I think I wouldn't like this nearly as much if it was just like Redbubble.
Yep. Or whatever. Me too. That was the appeal for me. It's technically an official Radio Shack shirt. Technically. Mm-hmm. It's doing a lot of heavy lifting in that sentence.
I have lost track a little bit of the, you know, like how Radio Shack works. I mean, I think we talked about, I think we went into this in some detail because there's what's it called in Canada? It's something else.
The source. The source. Because there's also Radio Shack in Canada, but then there's also The Source by Second City or no, by Circuit City.
Didn't that used to be an information service? The Source, Genie?
Oh, that's weird.
Maybe?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah, definitely, yeah, but I'm sure unrelated.
Sure.
The source was, that was one of the ones, I was sort of, somewhere I think I must have like a source information packet, you know, that I need to scan in, but anyway, the shirt's not super expensive, $24 shipping to me. It's on sale right now and in stock.
I kind of want one.
So
yeah, I like how print on demand is treated as in-store.
Well, yeah. All right. Okay, so now we can move on to our eBay auctions. And Blake, you have the first of these.
Sure. It's not what I've got here. It's not really earth-shaking in any particular way in as far as details or what it is. It's more price, I guess, and I'm curious to see if you agree. It's an Apple Macintosh 128K, comes with mouse, keyboard, original manual, no power cord. So I guess that means untested. There's some pictures here. The thing is, it's a buy it now of $550. Shipping calculate. Actually, it's located in North Garden, Virginia, which is a city I've never heard of before in my own state. So it probably, well, I'd have to calculate to find.
You wouldn't know it's in Canada.
Shipping price. So there's some pictures here. It's looks like, you know, Macintosh, external drive, a little bit dirty, sitting in the grass. It has the manuals with the disc and the
computers
case.
Are in the grass.
It has the interesting little, you know, the foam or pad, the nifty little Apple branded cozy that contained all the discs and the manuals and everything. Given that like the boxes for these, an empty box for this in mint condition will sell for $1,000 sometimes. So the buy it now of $550 seems like a pretty good price. This is an original. There's no indication that it works.
I'd want to see the back. Yeah. Is it an original 128, or is it a 128 that came out with the 512?
Well, it says this is an original, but it's very likely they don't know, you know, that they don't mean what you're asking. You'd have to see the back.
There's no photo of the back.
I don't know. I mean, certainly you can upgrade these, and I suppose if it's been upgraded, it would be less desirable in some way. But it certainly the front, like everything that we can see, looks consistent with it being an original, right? I mean, there's no writing on the front, and it has the vents on the top and stuff like that.
It has the vents on the top. It has the logo, I see there's a spider just above the internal floppy drive. you can nice. See.
It's buggy.
The discs, the little pamphlet. Looks like there's a very clean pamphlet with it. I don't know why it's in the grass, or it looks like it's sort of soiled. Anyway, does that strike you? I mean, it's a gamble because you don't know if it works, but does that seem like a... It just caught my eye for the price. Or,
yeah.
Or you can make an offer.
You'd have to risk... Yeah. You'd have to risk using a non-Apple branded power.
Yeah, right. That's yeah. True. I don't know. I mean, like, you know, this is one of those things where if I didn't already have it, how much would I want it? You know, because this feels like I feels high for what I, you know, like my own personal interest in it. But at the same time, I mean, you know, you might not be able to get one if you wanted one. You might not be able to get one for less than that.
Yeah, I guess. Yes. I'm speaking more of what I see these going for. Like, I don't I actually don't have a great desire for one. Like, I have a Mac Plus because, like, it's kind of an old one, but it's actually you can run a lot of things on it. You know, it has
it's actually usable.
Yeah, it's actually usable. So I enjoy that. I have no desire for this, but I see them pass for a great deal of money. I think I saw a mouse. You know, or not the mouse, the box that the mouse came in for like $250 and it sold. So I don't know. I just it caught my eye and that's it. That's all I got for the eBay this time.
Cool. Carrington, you have the next thing.
I have a computer that's not a computer. When is a computer not a computer? When it is a net appliance. Do you remember those things? So, these I find hilarious. So Net Appliance, this came out in 2001 by a company called Nata PC, and it was free. You could get this for free if you sign up for a 3-year commitment to their internet service. Had like $22 a month or whatever, and you had to open a checking account with a particular bank. It was some weird thing. And so if you opened a checking account with an internet-based computer bank and signed up for 3 years of internet service, you got yourself an Icebox, lowercase I, capital Sbox. And it is the most 2001 computer that ever 2001. It desperately wants to be a Mac Classic. The shape of it is just, it screams, please, I am a Mac Classic. Consider me a Mac Classic.
It's like to fool your friends.
The little bump on the back. Everything about it. Yeah. Now, it would be easy to see something like this and think it is not a computer because it has a DVD player in the front. It comes with a remote control. It also comes with an interesting looking keyboard. It's a membrane keyboard because it's a waterproof keyboard. The whole idea of this was the computer you put in your kitchen. So it has no storage, but it does come with an internal 56K modem to connect to the internet and through so you can use that as dial-up. I think it is not usable unless you have a phone that you could use a 56 modem to connect to a like slip server or something. So I don't know what you could do now, but you can still play DVDs on it. It's got a wireless waterproof keyboard, desperate need to be a Mac Classic. It's funny how you think of like Macs like the iMac influencing everything. Everything's Bondi Blue. Everything's transparent classic. And you forget like other computers also have massive impact. So here we get the lowercase I for Icebox, Icebox, and also the desperate need to look like an Apple. You hook up a printer to it. It's got video and audio out. I just love the fact that it's like it so desperately wants to do something else. But it's you get your heart healthy recipes book. I think it's amazing. Like it was a net appliance. You don't see a lot of those. Disappointingly, like this. In fact, in keeping with this sort of thing, this was a brand new, it's advertised as computer, sealed box, still new from 2001. Looks like it's totally sealed, which the person opened up to show you all the contents. So they opened it up and pulled it all out to take photographs. And that's not what still sealed means, man. So was slightly more collectible 5 minutes before this thing got auctioned off. So it's $250. Buy it now. If you're interested in collecting net appliances, you couldn't do better than this one, I think. I think it's hilarious.
I would love to have a half a dozen of these to give out to people and do as a challenge. So, like, what can you do with this? And then give them the box and say, go for it.
Well, you watch DVDs and you play CDs. So if you want something that's very 2001 looking, just to sit, not take up a ton of room and be like a DVD player with a tiny little 8-inch screen or whatever the heck this is. You could do worse. It's lovely. It's very. It's 2001. Mm. Boy, it's 2001.
It doesn't receive.
Looking at the inputs, you could hook a tuner. Like, you could do a tuner in.
Does it have a coax, like a cable in?
It's got video in. Yes,
it has a composite in.
Yeah.
So
you could feed it from. Yeah, I remember. I mean, there was a period like when the eye opener was out, like where there were a number of these internet appliances, and it offered a similar sort of thing. I had some experience with that, but there were a number of Diff Compact had some, but like they all were flat screen. I've never seen an information appliance that had a CRT. I never have. That's interesting. Mm.
So it could be a neat little way to play vintage games on it or whatever, like to hook up through the video in. I think it really caught my eye. So it's a Mac that's not a Mac. It's a computer that's not a computer. It's Icebox. It's not an Icebox. And it's sealed, but it's not sealed. Everything about this auction pleases me.
Well, the lowercase I really is.
And for Earl, it's untested.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunately on the box, really lowercase like, I. Is it? But if you ever see, I was reading through a whole bunch of their documentation from NataPC and when it got released and stuff, and all the press releases, and all of them want to spell it lowercase I, capital C E B O X.
Exactly. Yeah.
Delightful.
To make it seem Mac-like.
Yeah.
I wonder what the odds of the service having been in existence for a full 3 years are, as far as the 3 years that you had to subscribe. I wonder. Seems unlikely.
Yes, which means you could have picked it up cheap. Because you only pay $22 a year, and what if it only stayed around for 6 months or something? Cheap way to get one back in the day. But you can get one now for $250, buy now on eBay. So this is my choice.
Hmm. Excellent.
Paul, this is what you should buy this week.
It is cool. And it does remind me a little bit of these Audreys, right?
Of course it's cool. It's a nice box.
Right. But like the whatever, the Ergo Audreys that I was so fascinated by before that you can like it is possible to hack them and to do interesting other stuff with them. And this, I wonder if this is too much not a computer to be able to do anything with. Because the Ergo, at least the Audrey, at least had it had a little SD card in it and stuff. So
yeah, well, it's got AV in, it's got a coax in.
Yeah.
So. But then again, are there any analog TV services left to view natively on it?
Yeah. All right.
Lots of bits to plug in and use it, but oh god, so tempting, so not at that price.
Yeah. But I'd never seen this before. I mean, like it would have caught my attention, I think, if I'd seen just how much this looks like a Mac Classic.
Right.
Yeah. But,
okay, Michael, you have the next thing.
Oh, good. Okay, so what I've got here is a game from the ye olde good days. Now, what you see on the box top there is literally what the screen game area is. You are in an incomplete stockade, which is conveniently the hole is facing towards your oncoming enemies, and you have a gun, one gun. And the idea is you've got to hold them off, preferably before they actually get in your incomplete stockade. Now, it's available for all major platforms, Tandy, Apple, Commodore.
Sam Coupe?
Yes.
I hope. Yeah,
probably Sam Coupe. And possibly coming to an MC-10 near you. But, $60 Australian, so that's, what, about $9.95 US. But now it is showing you there. Okay, so 46-41 postage may not. Okay, so, yeah, if anyone in the US wants this and they can't find it over there, drop me a line. I can help you out. But, yeah, I think $60 or $46, however you want to look at it, it's a little bit overpriced for this game as it is. I'm sure I could find it somewhere else, but a better price. But it's complete, so it's got that going for it. So a little bit of extra information about your shell types that you can lob at your friendly foe. But very simple game from the era, along the lines of probably even less simple than the Battle for Midway and a few of the other Avalon Hill computer games of the day. I've come across a few Avalon Hill computer catalogs. I've scanned and put those up, so I might keep an eye out for this at a lower price. But if you're into very simple games, personally, I'd be playing it on any platform other than the Apple. The screenshots at Moby Games for this show the different platforms, and the least interesting is the Apple. Probably also the least interesting sound effects for the Apple as well, but we shan't go there.
Yeah. So Avalon Hill does a lot of these kind of board game type things. This one doesn't seem to actually come with pieces and things like that, but some do.
No. Nipa Riverline is one that I even enjoy playing that today. That's the computer plays the Russian, you play the German. You've got a map board, you've got counters, and it controls the visibility, the fog of war, and everything. So it's a good one because you might catch a fleeting glance of armor coming towards you, and you lose line of sight on it, and then basically next thing you know about it, it's blowing your engineers to bits. But these are a different style of game to what the young folk are used to these days. So I would recommend getting out there and trying one online or in an emulator, just for the experience of why you shouldn't rush out and buy it.
I have a few of these Avalon Hill games, and so they came on a couple different formats. Some were on floppy disk, some were on cassette, and I kind of like these cassette ones because they have many, many platforms on this cassette. So you have the Atari 800 and Apple II on one side. You have a whole bunch of things that I can't even really read on the screen, on the other side. But
that was actually the benefit of the cassette tape over the floppy disks, because everyone used the cassette tape and just had an audio file on it. None of this disk format structures and things to worry about booting it up and all that stuff that gets in the way. So I suppose this is an example of the glory days of cassette-loaded microcomputer games, and I suppose from Avalon Hill's perspective, it was a good way of getting multi-platform and just having one production queue, sort of not worrying about which cassette goes in where.
There's a item of interest and or news that I did not talk about, and I will talk about next time probably, about making a multi-format floppy that boots on a Commodore and an Apple and I think a Atari.
Well, without flipping it over onto all three sides.
Amazing little engineering feat. But it's kind of like this, in a way, like getting the data for all the different systems on a single bit of media.
I'm currently sharing a screen because I would like to take issue with some things that were said. And I went over to Moby Games and looked at these displays. And everything looks way better on the Apple II for this game than the other platforms, in my opinion. Uh-huh. The Apple II has actual graphics. The rest of them are basically text things.
So we're getting a platform war.
Platform wars are well
Apple
and truly still
users.
Alive. So on the Apple II, you get a graphic. Are they good graphics? No. But you have a little fence. You have your marching people. You got little characters blowing the heck out of them, and you got text on the screen. Okay. Is it good looking? No. Does it have tons of bleed? Yes. Let's look at what the Commodore looks like. Okay. Here's your Commodore screen. What the heck? It's ASCII art at best. Come on. These lines are your marching characters? No. The Apple II is by far the best of this. TRS-80, same thing. Text.
Well, you're looking at the PET version.
All the versions are terrible.
Is there...
Okay, let's look at the Commodore. Let's look at the Commodore 64. Okay, here's your 64. Oh, wow. How is that better?
Ooh, that's worse
these
than
things are huge.
PET.
This is text. Exactly.
Ooh. Yeah.
Apple II for the win. I'm just saying.
I think you're right, Carrington.
No, it's just... Apple II user here. I did not like the implementation of the graphics for this. It could have easily have been better. It was a case of, we've done text-based for all the others. Let's slap some graphics in for the Apple I. Even by Avalon Hill standards of the day, it was crappy.
But the reason is there wasn't room on the cassette after you squeezed in all this crappy other platforms.
I'm sure that these are basically like one basic program, saved out to all the different formats.
One core basic program, and then you just sort of change the subroutine for the display.
Yeah, so it's like it's the same. It's the lowest common denominator, Infocom type stuff. But
are there any other?
All right,
I didn't. Point made. Did we look at everything?
Yeah.
We did. I think we've seen all of them.
Did we see the MC-10 version?
No, that's not on Moby Games. Yeah.
No, that. But I'm sure it's coming
soon.
The
Sam Coupe version, I hear, is amazing. It's in 4K, yeah. And that was in 1992. All right.
Okay, platform wars have ended for now. Ceasefire, yeah. Ceasefire.
Okay, and so I am going to do one.
What?
And I'll pick up the other ones next time.
And suddenly, hosts were dropping off left, right, and center.
So it is the Prince of Persia, Sam Coupe version.
Of course it is.
You're killing me, man.
Yeah. Although you have to hurry because there's only 10 hours left. But
suspicious.
Yeah. But it is Prince of Persia, Broderbund, big box. Has a floppy Sam Coupe disc. It looks like Dumark is
this scam runs deep, doesn't it?
It's unreal.
Yeah. But anyway, yes.
I'll give them an A+ for effort.
That's right. It is 119.99 Great British pounds, which is approximately $170.
Yeah. Are they that great at the moment?
I mean, everyone knows that is the best version of Prince of Persia. The Sam Coupe version is well known as being the best version. So
it probably suspiciously won't ship to Canada. I'm like, nice try.
Anyway.
Or just one part of Canada it doesn't ship to.
So
the part where my supposed girlfriend is.
In Singapore.
Anyway, I thought that was pretty good. That's good.
Working at Radio Shack.
Leave it at that. Okay, and now I think we can go to the closing discussions. I think that when I shorten my eBay auctions, that section becomes very short. But anyway.
Yeah.
And Carrington, you have the first thing.
Oh, just a really quick note. I mean, it's not really good enough for news yet, but there's rumors going around. Well, not rumors. It's been reporting that Roberta and Ken Williams of Sierra fame are collaborating on a brand new game, which will be very Sierra adventure game-like. It's the first one they're doing in over 20 years. I'm excited. Shut up and take my money. Whatever it is, I will be buying it.
Yeah.
So it's not really news yet because the game's not out. They're just now starting to work on it. But they say they finally had a great idea, and they've hired a graphics person to be involved in it, and they're going to be pushing out a new adventure game, and I'm quite excited.
I've bought and read their books. Love it. And this is definitely the just take shut up and take my money meme here. I'm in.
Cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
So something to look forward to. I'm really excited about it.
Blake, do you have I skipped over you because you hadn't typed anything, but do you have any closing notes?
No, I hadn't. Nothing in particular. Just trying to make it to the cicadas. I did hear word on the street is that Errata Online, you know, Thomas Cherryholme's Plato system, port is underway for the Sam Coupe, and so I'm hoping to use that. Yeah. I'm looking forward to getting online with that when it lands. Mm. So he's hit
my friend Roberta just DM'd me that it's the Sham Coupe, and I wish I thought of that. Nicely done. Okay.
But yes, otherwise. That about summarizes it for me.
Fantastic. Jack?
Yeah, I finally ordered a FujiNet, the device we've been talking about quite often for the Atari 8-bits. There's a new, the latest hardware version is version 1.5, and I was waiting for that to be available, which now is, so I ordered that. I have that in my hands in a few weeks, probably. So I'm looking forward to finally playing with that and
bouncing a ball from,
bouncing a ball across the world.
Excellent. Michael?
No, the only thing I've got is that I've been having lots of fun scanning stuff from my library downstairs. Just go through the different bookshelves, so many to choose from, and just grabbing stuff and dropping it on the scanners that I've got. I'll just share the link to my account uploads, and if anyone's interested, just go in, have a look, and just find out what's going on. And if you do have anything that you think is worthwhile scanning, reach out. There's we can find someone near you to actually scan it and preserve it for you if you don't have the equipment to do it.
Oh, right. Yeah, if you have something physically that is in need of scanning. Yeah, I was going to just say too that for those who have not been following the Facebook page, Michael has been posting things on the Facebook page somewhat as they are. I'm assuming that's highlights, not just everything, but
The highlights.
To what are
just follow the hashtag 8-bit bunker scanning if you're on Twitter land.
Yeah. Right after you follow Pony Information.
Yes,
subscribed.
Excellent. And let's see what. What's been going on with me? Oh, I discovered. Last time I think we mentioned Carrington had suggested going to the PRIF meetings, the People's Republic of Interactive Fiction.
In Boston.
And I had mentioned that I had physically gone to one sometime in the past. It was that Case Avitz was also at, and I remember somebody talking about something like restoring the Perestroika game, and it turned out it was actually the guy who was restoring the Perestroika game who was talking about that actual project. So I happened to be in a meeting when that was being discussed, and I didn't entirely recognize it, but
very cool.
I also mentioned, I think, that I have an SX64 and it was not behaving right, or the keyboard wasn't working, and it turns out so in the SX64, there's a little board. It was sort of some kind of poor design. It plugs in at a 90-degree angle with some pins into a socket, and they're sort of famous for coming loose sort of making not very good contacts, kind of like the Apple III, I suppose. So I opened mine up and took a look, and it turned out that it hadn't gotten loose. It was in fact just flapping around, in there, not connected to anything. So I connected it back up, and my keyboard actually did start working. So I'm one step closer. So
cool.
And what else? I got a solid state thing for the Timex Sinclair 2068. I think we talked about this this thing that would transforms it into something like some game console that then there's a converter for the game console to HDMI. And so I got that kind of working. I'll talk about that maybe next time. I feel like too many notes for this already overtime show, but I'm getting there. I'm setting things up.
Cool. So
all right, let's see, and is there anything else that we should talk about? Brandon asked in the comments if there's and Michael's typing in the comments a reply, but I'll say it anyway. Brandon was asking for the scanning, do you chop the binding off, or do you just use a feeder? What do you do when you scan? I'm curious.
Okay, as I replied, if the magazine is plentiful in the wild, I have no hesitation of doing a little bit of French Revolution on the magazine, and
I think it's the head that they remove.
Down comes the guillotine. I'm not a good shot. It's AKA me and keyboards. Aim for the head, got the spine. I will not destroy a book if I'm going to go scan it. What I've actually been doing, I've got quite a few books on there. The process that I had been using was to basically just open the book up and face down onto the scanner. So I'll be doing the left page, right page in the scan. Then I'm using a program called Scan Tailor Advanced. It's available for Mac, Linux, and Windows, and allows you to split the pages so you can automatically most of the time get it right. Your left and right pages, you can adjust it before you move to the next step, has automatic disk skewing. Good work for just going straight into black and white. So if you've got a very old book or a not so old book with yellowed paper or somewhat a little bit moldy or in places as well, just the default settings actually does quite a good job of rendering it back to a white background, black text, quite good. I've also been using those overhead cameras that will do A3 size, And I did one book from my wife's childhood books section, and wasn't overly happy with the cheap USB one that I bought on eBay. Went and got the DeathScan Pro version from IrisScan, a Canon company. That was better, but it's not that great. And a friend of mine has bought one of those U-Boot fancy, very expensive Curza, C-U-R-Z or whatever it is, or C-U-Z-R, whatever ones. And he hasn't tried it out yet, so I'm going to get hold of that and try that for see how good the routines are for de-skewing the pages. So you'll have the warp of the pages as the book is open. Even the Canon one that I use has in the documentation to use your fingers to in the middle of the pages to hold it as flat as possible while it's taking the scan, and it does a supposedly a finger detect so that it doesn't actually show the fingers in the scan because it's actually taking video and it's still at the same time. I think it's just sort of like figures out that the funny blobby things on the edge of the page are fingers. So I don't think it actually has too great an AI in there. But it unfortunately only saves as JPEG. And I like to get my original scans as TIFF, but it was workable, but it wasn't the greatest. So I still ended up using the dewarping in ScanTailor just to tune that up a bit, so I've just skipped that altogether. So for larger books, I'm trying to find myself a reasonably priced large format flatbed scanner. Unfortunately, good A3 scanners are frightfully expensive, and I'm talking in the when they say that's sub 1,000 pricing, they're talking like high $900 marks just for a basic quality A3 scanner. So I'm keeping my eye out for older ones that even if I've got to hook up via an emulator. So if I've got to put a parallel to USB adapter in and run it under XP or Windows 2000 or Mac OS 9, I don't really care. I've got emulators things coming out the wazoo. Do a lot of my work in emulated virtual machines anyway, because I hate paying to upgrade software just to make it run outside of Windows 98 or Windows 95 or 2000. Emulators and virtual machines are good these days that you can actually run an emulated machine that's actually faster than the hardware of the day. So, yeah. And then I just use various TIFF to PDF converters and upload it to the Internet Archive. So. The main crux is if you're having problems with your scans, ScanTailor Advanced. Look it up, get it for your platform. Great piece of software.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've sort of stayed away from de-skewing. De-skewing I do, but certainly de-curling I haven't.
Yeah, de-warping. Yeah, de-curling and de-warping is, yeah, it's problematical. I found that the ScanTailor Advanced de-warping is actually one of the better ones, but it also allows you to get in and put in your corners and edges, so it's good that way, and also on a per page basis, so you can get in there. And most of them I don't bother, but sometimes I just get in there and tweak up the if it's too bad.
I think we've seen some videos of like the Internet Archive things where they actually have like glass that holds it open at an angle.
Yeah, they use basically a 90-degree, 135-degree glass angle, so it comes down onto the book. And I've been looking at DIY book scanners, building one. Now that I've got my 3D printer, I can get in there. I'm looking at building, fabbing the plastic bits to join all the aluminium extrusions that I could actually buy to do it. I've got hold of a couple of older generation phones, iPhones, to use as the cameras because they're reasonable quality and they're flat and easy to mount and easy to interface with and to get the photos off. So I'd have one photo doing left page and another camera doing photos of right page and then just merging those together. And I'll see how that goes. But that's a lot of building and mucking around to even just get to the prototyping stage to see how I go. But if I can get a glass or perspex 90 degree or 135 degree in there to hold the book open and as flat as possible. And theoretically, you can get up to quite a good rhythm and speed once you get going. So might be seeing me in there with a treadle foot-operated book scanner at some stage. But I just love going through and just finding old magazines, not just computer stuff. So my uploads are not just retro computing. There is a travel magazine from 1901, which is just from a snapshot of history, is just superb. Yeah. All of the travel items of that era is just great, cool. Including your Hennessy's to have a wee dram before you go.
It's a very, very Australian phrase. But yeah, that angling thing was certainly the problem of a lot of things that I was scanning with a flatbed. Mm. That you know, if you have a thick thing or you have a thing with a weak binding, it's really hard to deal with. And so I was hoping to get some sort of pyramid.
Yeah, I've got some that are, I had one program catalog which I was just going to open up and do it on a flatbed scanner one page at a time. As I opened the book, it cracked. Not only did it crack, but the gum started falling out on the floor. So I thought, I could either close this up and not do it, or as I just gave the book a minor tap and it came out of the cover, and then I just started flicking it with my thumb and all the gum came off the not-so-perfect binding anymore. And then that's when I just went and then fed it through my document feeder.
Yeah.
Got rid of all the dusty particles of gum off the edge and just ran that through the document feeder. 300 pages about a minute later, and they were all TIFFs in a folder ready to be turned into a document for uploading. So where I can, automated document feeds are the way to go. You can get past all the boring scanning part and all to the interesting proofing and reading and creating the upload. But many a time I've done a scan and then I've started flipping through the products of the scan one page at a time, engrossed in what I've scanned. So I've fallen behind my one object per day.
It's definitely worth doing that, though, because I have occasionally come across times when I've missed, page 37 and 38, and it's so annoying to have to go back and try to figure out where you put
or
that a
or you end up with two page 16s, which is not
quite as bad. Actually, I end up with a lot of duplicates like that because I don't trust I don't trust the scan. I would rather do it again and fix it than post.
Oh, no, I just sort of get into a rhythm. I call it delayed scanning. I would put a book onto the scanner and hit scan. I would go and do something with last year, a lot of working from home. And you get to the stage where, did I scan that or not? And say a press scan again. And then sometimes you go, I just pick up the book, turn it to the next page, scan it again. You go back, you're missing two pages. But you can fix all that and then just do an insert and update. But slow scanning was the way I did quite a few things to start with because, working from home, got two monitors going with stuff, one monitor with the scanner, and the scanner was sitting there not doing anything while I was programming.
All right, so.
we could do a podcast about scanning.
We could. We should.
Yeah, later.
But not today.
We just did.
Not today.
I think that's quite true. All right, well, let's see if we can maybe turn this off before we hit the 3-hour mark. Thanks though, everybody, for hanging out in the chat as long as you did. It is amazing actually that we managed to keep all the people in the chat that whole time. And thanks everyone for joining us in the podcast. I think next time we will continue to talk a little bit more about school things with anyone who's new. And that's it for the show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show on the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. Please write a review on iTunes. That will help people find the show, perhaps. Write in about your stories about the Sam Coupe. And until next time,
Retro-Compute! It's a place of love and color where pretty girls and
I did not actually make up the Sam Cooke. I'm going to go on record and say...
You're in on it.
I also was duped if it was a big, long con.
I will not be fooled. Not again.